Politicians who seem to be thirsting for more violence on our streets, who seem to feel that it would boost their political fortunes or indeed drive more traffic to their platforms. But on the other hand, you also have normally sensible people adding to calls for this move. And it means that they're doing it for very different reasons. And that means that one lot is wrong and one lot is right.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Israel's defence minister has insisted the IDF will follow the government's orders on its operations in Gaza. It follows reports of opposition from senior military officials over a potential expansion of the campaign. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is said to be pushing for a total reoccupation of Gaza. Former peace negotiator Daniel Levy says Mr. Netanyahu is facing growing dissent.
And the core of that disagreement over how to proceed, not whether to proceed, and I think we have to understand that, that how to proceed with the next phase is that the heads of the military are saying, if you send us into these areas, Mr. Prime Minister, the likelihood that more of those remaining living Israelis will be harmed, will not come out alive, increases exponentially.
A leading think tank has warned Rachel Reeves is facing a £41 billion shortfall in meeting her economic rules. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research says there will have to be moderate but sustained increases in taxes this year. The Treasury says it's strengthening the public finances by delivering growth. Downing Street's new funding will tackle a worrying trend of children becoming isolated at home. The £88 million for youth services in England will pay for services like youth clubs, climbing walls and music lessons. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandes, told LBC the money will be directed where it's most needed.
£88 million on its own is not going to reverse a decade and a half of decline or a generation where the majority of young people say they spend all or almost all of their free time alone in their bedrooms online. This is the floor, not the ceiling of our ambition. This is the down payment on us working with this generation to really grip the challenges that they face.
Lisa Nandes told LBC she's not currently confident the BBC can avoid a repeat of its Glastonbury controversy. She says the broadcaster has committed to a series of changes after streaming punk duo Bob Villain, leading a chant of death to the IDF. Donald Trump's health secretaries confirmed plans to cut $500 million of vaccine funding. Robert F. Kennedy has claimed the mRNA technology poses more risks than benefits. It's widely considered to be safe and effective and was a critical part of ending the COVID pandemic. Ministers have urged Santander to drop plans to start charging some small businesses for their banking. The lender had in the past promised the accounts would be free forever. It now says the landscape has changed significantly. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 91.60. That is up 17. The pound buys $1.32 and a euro 14. LBC weather, most areas fine and dry with sunny spells. The cloud increasing across the west in the afternoon, a high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Mom?
Dad?
We need to chat.
I think I'm old enough for a phone.
All my mates have one.
I want to be in the group chat.
But is it true when you post something...
It's kind of hard to take back.
Or strangers might message me.
That they're fake accounts.
Bots. Toxic comments.
I want to know what's right and what's not.
So can we have the chat? You know, the phone chat?
It can be hard to know what to do when it comes to kids and phones. Search EE Phone Chat from the UK's best network.
To verify best network, see ee.co.uk/claims.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. It's 3 minutes after ten, and you are listening to, I hope this doesn't come as a major surprise to you, James O'Brien on LBC. I craved your indulgence a bit yesterday, didn't I? And I still don't know the answer to one of the questions that I asked you. When, quotes, the rest of the world, end quotes, is obsessing about immigration to the point that incredible levels of misinformation are being swallowed wholesale by the public. And we'll have a little look at how the Daily Mail chose to report the gulf between facts and feelings this morning, the story that we talked about yesterday. What do you do if you're not obsessed by it? What do you do if you recognise that immigration is not the reason why inequality is rife in this country? What do you do if you recognise that the real problems lie with distribution of wealth and incredible pandering to privilege and capital? Do you just ignore all the noise that's going on around you, even as your fellow citizens, your fellow subjects of this realm are being turned into furious conduits for rage, discrimination, hatred, and, of course, increasingly, perhaps, violence? Do you let your sensibilities steer you away from the subject matter because you know that it's been dominated by dangerous liars? And obviously, as I say those words out loud, of course you don't. You can't. It's tempting. Of course it's tempting, the lure of an easy life. I suppose for some people it's even tempting to join in and to recognise the fact that it is so much easier to sell tickets for the ghost train than it is for the Sweet Your Weight machine. So why wouldn't you join in this madness that has created a country in which 4% of people who come here do so irregularly, and yet huge swathes of the population believe that the number who come here irregularly is higher than the number who don't. So somehow 4% becomes 50, 60, 70%. I mean, it is madness, but that was yesterday's show. The question simply is, what decent people should do to address this warped narrative? The first answer to that question is obviously keep calling it a warped narrative. Keep pointing out the facts. Keep hitting the numbers. Keep relying on trusted sources. Keep telling the truth. But that only takes you so far, because government will sometimes do things that will delight the dangerous liars. And the dangerous liars call upon governments to do things. But that doesn't mean that all of those things are wrong. I know that sounds a little bit weird, but some of the voices, I think Keir Starmer is one of them, Yvette Cooper is one of them, the danger that they are pandering to the racist narrative regarding immigration is real, and it may be something that we discuss on the programme today. But here is the problem, right? I think I've worked it out. I think I've worked out what my problem is. Just this one problem. I've got 99 problems, but that ain't one. I think I've worked it out. And so on the one side, I mean, I don't think we can name names yet, but you're welcome to fill in the gaps yourself. There are clearly people in public life who are praying for more riots. Whether they reach the editorial floors of national newspapers or the floor of the House of Commons, that's up to you. You take your own view on that. I've got my own view, but it would not be right to say at this point that so and so is clearly thirsting for more violence. Not in the context of public figures, but you can fill in the gaps yourself. Some people clearly want more violence. You can tell sometimes because they are championing people who called for pogroms last summer. Some fascinating research, by the way, published by Amnesty International today, showing the role that Elon Musk's platform played in the spreading of false narratives and harmful content, which contributed to the racist violence against Muslim and migrant communities that we saw last summer. And I don't think it's controversial to say to you, there are people out there, some of whom are heavily involved in the dissemination of lies on Elon Musk's platform, who clearly welcome the racist violence against Muslim and migrant communities. And they are calling for the police to reveal more details of suspects in alleged crimes, okay? They are calling for the public to be given more information on the background of suspects. And Yvette Cooper has joined them, which means either that there are reasons to do this that do not involve thirsting for more racist violence, or Yvette Cooper is thirsting for more racist violence, or Yvette Cooper is bending over backwards to appease the people calling for racist violence. Is that fair? Do you think those are three analyses of why the actual Home Secretary would call for the police to reveal more information about suspects in crimes? Because A, she thinks it would achieve something positive. B, she agrees with the people who are thirsting for more racist violence, or C, she's so frightened of the people thirsting for more racist violence that she has decided to throw them a bone. I'm going to run that through again, because I'm thinking out loud with you here. So when a Home Secretary calls for something that is also being called for by precisely the same people who helped cause the racist riots last summer by using Elon Musk's platform to spread all manner of misinformation, lies and racist provocation, up to and including the people jailed for literally calling publicly for pogroms, for buildings full of human beings to be set fire to. Yvette Cooper is either on their side, which seems to me to be a ridiculous suggestion, sufficiently frightened of them to try to appease them by giving them something that they want, which seems to me to be, and we can have this argument, we will have this argument. Nathan thinks it's that simple. She is appeasing the right, nothing more, nothing less. I disagree. I think that that is palpably absurd, actually, I would go as far as to suggest. But I could be wrong, and that's why today's phone-in is going to, I hope, be a very interesting one. Or thirdly, she thinks it's going to achieve something very different from what the people thirsting for more racist violence think. And this is where it gets really interesting. Because that analysis involves her and Starmer knowing the actual numbers. That analysis involves them knowing that if you were to release the ethnicity of people accused, for example, of sexual violence, then the massive, the overwhelming majority will be British-born men. That is a statistical certainty. You will get some variation demographically, caused largely by socioeconomic status, but of course you could manipulate it however you wished to look at asylum status, refugee status, star sign, geographical location, religious affiliation, whatever you wanted to. But the bottom line will be, as the rather splendid author who has turned his hand to fiction, I should tell you, latterly, has written this morning, the secret barrister who works in this field, writing that I prosecute and defend the most serious sexual offences in our courts. The overwhelming majority of offenders are British-born. Overwhelmingly, the victim is someone known to them, either a partner or relative. Anybody purporting to care about protecting women might start there. A timely moment to remind you, of course, that the Reform Party invited into Parliament, ushered into Parliament, a man who'd actually been jailed for battering his former girlfriend, and the leaders of that organisation then sought to defend the decision not to tell voters about it before the election took place. So the question of who is genuinely interested in protecting women becomes pertinent. The secret barrister goes on, there are significant problems with the way that sexual violence is dealt with in the criminal justice system. Chronic underreporting, I would add to that, unless it involves people of certain ethnicities or asylum statuses, in which there is arguably chronic overreporting. I would say there isn't chronic overreporting, it's just that all the other reporting should catch up. Investigations take years, we're back to austerity and cuts. The court backlog, we're back to austerity and cuts, means several more years before a trial. Some complainants even give up and some prosecutions collapse. Don't let con artists and hate mongers distract from the real issues. So that is what I think is happening here. I think that Keir Starmer and Yvette Cooper and others, including David Gawk and I think Dominic Grieve, people from both sides of the political divide in this country, I think they believe that if the information is given to the public, then the hugely disproportionate focus upon alleged offenders of a certain ethnicity or of from ethnic minorities, let's just put it that simply, regardless, I think, of asylum status, but we can bring that into it as well. So Starmer and Cooper and Gawk and Grieve are obviously hoping that if you give the actual information to the actual people, then they will arrive at actually different conclusions. They will realise that this is not the, quote, tinderbox, end quote, issue that many people thirsting for more violence want it to be or describe it to be. So, who's right? Because you remember the events in Liverpool a few months ago, where the ethnicity of the suspect was immediately released, with the, I think, fairly obvious intention of refuting the idea that the suspect was from an ethnic minority or a refugee. And it's a weird thing to say, and it's a live case, so we will say no more about it. But that decision to release biographical details about the suspect in the hope of preventing racist violence worked. But I said to you during the Southport tragedy, the murders in Southport, and in the immediate aftermath of that, when everybody focused so heavily upon the fact that lies had been spread by various public figures, I said to you then, what's the subtext here? Yeah, the fact that he was born in Wales and raised as a Christian, the murderer in that case, was cited as a reason why people shouldn't be rioting. But I said to you at the time, what if he hadn't been? What if he had been born overseas? What if he had sought asylum in this country? Would the people saying, don't riot because he's British, be silenced and compelled to argue, you can riot because he's not? That's glib. It's a little bit simplistic, but you understand the point that I'm making. We set so much store by the fact that this was not a man who fit any of the descriptions that the various liars on Elon Musk's platform and beyond claimed, that the possibility or the what would happen, the consequences if it had been true that he was an asylum seeker or that he was a Muslim or that he was a member of a currently heavily othered ethnic minority, would have somehow seemed to me like a green light to the people indulging in the racist violence. So, who do you think is right? Some people clearly want this information to be released by the police because they hope it will prompt more violence. And some people think that by releasing this information, and the massive majority of suspects in such cases will be British born, they think that when those statistics get into the public space, the heat that is being very, very carefully stoked on this issue will diminish. And I don't know who's right. I worry about right-wing politicians, most obviously Kemi Badenoch, being terminally online. She seems to plan her every move and wiggle according to what is happening on social media. Honest Bob Jenrick similarly. But I worry that the other lot are too detached from it. They don't understand the tidal waves of filth and hatred that are washing up on our screens and across our country, put there by people who are motivated by the worst of instincts, the very, very worst of us. And those are the people, perhaps, who are the sensibles in this case, the ones who are saying, no, look, everything's getting very, very heated. If people actually knew the truth, then things would be less heated. But this is a country in which people have been successfully persuaded that the majority of migration is illegal, when the actual proportion is 4% of the total. And there's even, I think, a debate to be had about the use of the word illegal in that context, because the massive majority of them have their asylum applications approved. They are found to be worthy and deserving recipients of refugee status. So we have got an incredible tension upon which public safety depends. Who is right? The people who think that you should release more details of a suspect's ethnicity because the way that the press and some politicians have sought to pretend that people from ethnic minorities are massively overrepresented in these crimes, or the people who, I think we can say with full confidence, really, really want every accusation levelled against an asylum seeker or a member of an ethnic minority to be trumpeted from the rooftops because they think it will be a clarion call for more racist violence. And I don't know who's right. The people who think that the facts will matter or the people who think that the feelings will be stoked by selective dissemination of certain facts. That's all I've got. Actually, I haven't got a pivotal question for you. I haven't got a Well, I think, I mean, the question is who is right, but I hope I've successfully described the two camps. One contains sensible people, one contains dangerous liars, and they are calling for the same thing for very different reasons. Whose reasons do you think are more likely to be proved true? The people who think this will diffuse racist propaganda, or the people who think it will increase the likelihood of racist violence? There you go. Oh, I'm sometimes a bit hard on myself. That's a perfect question. That's neat, it's distilled, and it's straightforward. Two groups of people calling for exactly the same thing. More information about suspects in crimes to be released to the public, chiefly with regard to ethnicity and asylum status. Who do you think is right? The people who think it will diffuse the very carefully stoked atmosphere that we're living in at the moment, or the people who are clearly hoping that it will tip things over the edge and cause more violence? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need.
LBC.
So, where are we going?
You wanted to try something new? Well, we're here.
The Hyundai Electrifying Summer Event.
I booked a test drive in the all-new Insta online. It's the 2025 World Electric Vehicle winner, and we save £500 if we order before the 31st of August.
Ooh, very stylish.
Oh, and it's Hyundai, by the way.
The Hyundai Electrifying Summer Event. Are you in? 18 plus UK retail customers only. Excludes Motability. Registered by 30th of September. T's and C's apply.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Am I on a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6. T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
22 minutes after 10. And I suppose the question that underpins all of this is, why do you want the police to reveal more about the background of suspects? 0345 6060 973. Or, of course, why don't you want the police to be compelled to reveal more information about the background of suspects? That simple distinction between people who think it will cause more violence and people who think releasing the actual facts and figures will reduce the likelihood of violence. Who's going to win their bet? Andrew's in Penzance. Andrew, what would you like to say?
Morning, James. LTL, FTC, if I may use a full partridgeism.
I'd need to translate that now. Long time listener, first time caller, but thank you. Carry on. What do you reckon on this one?
Well, I actually did that to save time, but it actually ended up...
Get on with it, man!
All right. So I listen to you every day, pretty much. I have a very high opinion for what you do.
Thank you.
But I think that you labour under a very positive misapprehension, which is that facts are good at changing people's opinions.
Yeah.
And from Goebbels to Professor Sam Vessier, currently a Canadian professor, all the evidence says that facts are pretty useless.
It's not all the evidence, is it?
No, lots of evidence.
There is lots of evidence. But if we're going to be doing fact policing, I think we should start with a little bit of low level fact. It's not all the evidence, and it's not just me either. I'm more interested in what is motivating Yvette Cooper and David Gawk and Keir Starmer and Dominic Grieve and others.
Well, it may well be an effort for them, as you indicate, to fight back. But I'm just saying that it won't matter if it shows that most perpetrators are white British. It won't have any effect because, you know, people won't suddenly stop being racist because they hear a few facts. In fact, in Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote that if you want to dominate as a political party, you need people to believe in an article of faith rather than on evidence, because evidence can be challenged.
But then we just give up and go home. How do you fight what you're describing, or how do you challenge what you're describing, and how do you deal with the people who, for example, are very, very loud on the subject of the ethnicity of suspects should be revealed, but the actual convictions of parliamentary candidates for violence against British women shouldn't be shared until a newspaper gets hold of the story and reveals it long after that person has arrived in Parliament as a colleague of Nigel Farage. So how do you address that level of epic hypocrisy and dishonesty?
To a certain extent, you have to take a leaf out of their playbook. And if I can give you an example of what I mean. About 25 years ago, a professor, I think at University of Wisconsin, but I may be wrong,
yes,
he was a big advocate against capital punishment. And after years of trying to make the arguments and getting nowhere, he decided to round up a load of people who'd been exonerated on death row. And he took them around theatres and put them on stage,
yeah,
telling their story of how they would be dead now, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this became super successful. In fact, so much so, it went round the world and they ran out of death row people, so they had to use actors in the end. And it had the biggest impact on moratoria on capital punishment in American states of anything that's ever been done. But it was appealing to people's emotions.
Because they were stories. It was stories, yes, not data.
Exactly. Correct.
And I don't know what those stories look like, but you need a counter-narrative of positivity, you know, the refugees who've gone on to be doctors, or who've gone on to be successful entrepreneurs, or who have gone on to be care workers and teachers and taxi drivers and just helping keep the fabric of our society ticking happily along. But you're not going to get much news coverage of those people, are you? Well, the news coverage of the tiny minority who do bad things not only dwarfs the massive majority who don't, but also is disproportionately reported compared to people born here being accused of or committing identical crimes.
Correct. And in fact, if you demonstrated that most perpetrators are white, the right would just change the narrative anyway.
Which is a point that Harley picks up. The elements of the right wing will still kick off as soon as a migrant commits a crime, even if the first 20 or the first 200 to commit the same crime have been British-born or are white. Thank you, Andrew. A sparkling debut with the kind of sprinkling of academic reference that warms the cockles of my heart. But it's a bleak analysis. And it means that Yvette Cooper and Keir Starmer and David Gawke and Dominic Grieve may mean well, but they are being horribly naive by thinking that the facts can quell these sorts of feelings. I hope Andrew's wrong, but that's why I'm torn on this, because I think we've established the parameters of the debate and I don't know which horse is going to win. I don't know what horse I'd put my money on. Recent events have taught us to put the money on the dangerous racist liars because they keep winning. Dean's in Durham. Dean, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Thank you. First time caller. So, I'd just like to say, I'd like to think that the facts would win out, and that if used responsibly, that would win people over. But I think from experience, from what we've seen, that won't happen. That selective stats will be used, as they're always used, to push agendas. I mean, at the moment, we don't see, for example, the press, the media. There's a lot to answer for the media, but
for sure.
They don't go to airports. They don't look at the stats of everybody coming in, migrating to the country who isn't in a boat. So there's already...
You mean over 96, over 96% exactly of the people coming
exactly
in?
Exactly that, yes. The vast majority, they have no interest in. So they look at the minority and they push that agenda and they push that story and they push it out of proportion to make a story, to make sensationalism, because they need to sell papers. So if we give them more stats, will they not use them for the same thing?
Well, you've almost teed this up perfectly, because we talked yesterday about the YouGov polling showing that 96%, 4% dichotomy that I just referred to, or distinction. The Daily Mail gets its hands on the same story today and opens with the headline, 45% of Britain's back end to immigration. And then goes in on nearly half of voters support ending immigration and deporting those who arrived in the UK in recent years, a poll has shown. And then gives you the percentage of Britons who back this scenario where no new migrants are arrived. And then you're in paragraph three, as alongside the headline, where 86% of Reform UK voters and 27% of Labour and Liberal Democrats backed this. And then in paragraph five, you get this slightly confusing paragraph, but the YouGov research suggested there was a common misconception about immigration in Britain, as 47% of respondents thought there were more migrants in the UK illegally than legally. Do you know what doesn't appear in this entire article, all 10 or 11 paragraphs of it, is that percentage, that 4%, 96% dichotomy. So you could actually read that story, and how many people read things closely, and not come away understanding just how great the gulf is between reality and perception. In fact, if you're part of the deluded, if you're part of the misled, if you're among the half of voters supporting ending immigration and deporting those who arrived in the UK, you could come away from that article feeling vindicated without knowing that you've just been sold a box full of bricks.
And I think the problem there is that at the moment, the government is not very good at getting its messaging out properly. Really trying to target those people and just say, look, here is, or at least here is a massive source of information. Go and look for yourself if you've got the time and the inclination. But if not, here's an alternative view for you to consider. Here are the stats.
And it's a bleak, analysis because the government is potentially betting the house on this, and they could end up making everything worse.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's not helped, once again, by, you know, individuals like Nigel Farage, who are constantly platformed without challenge on media stations, left, right and centre. You know, you could at least, with these stats available, presenters could, in real time, fact-check Nigel Farage and others.
Well, that's a positive. Say, well, but then it depends on presenters actually using the statistics responsibly and in the public interest.
And that's the point. All of this comes down to responsibility. And I don't think we've seen enough responsibility from the people who should be using these numbers.
Well, the Daily Mail is doing your work for you here by taking the numbers and presenting them in such a way that makes it impossible to see the true scale of the problem. And absolutely absent from this article is the from the print version that I've got in front of me is that idea that the reality is 4% and nearly half of voters think the reality is in excess, in some cases well in excess of 50%. So in that crucible of misinformation and gaslighting, what will these statistics do? Or what will this information do? The background of suspects. 100 people commit a crime. How confident are you that they will all receive equal coverage? Or will the 1 in 100, will the 1% of the problem, who is either foreign-born or even an asylum seeker, will they be a bandwagon upon which all the usual suspects jump in the hope of provoking more violence on our streets? 10:32 is the time. Thomas Watts has your headlines.
Donald Trump's envoy has arrived in Moscow in the hope of securing a breakthrough to end the war in Ukraine. Steve Witkoff is holding talks with Vladimir Putin 2 days ahead of a ceasefire deadline set by Mr. Trump. A potential Israeli plan to reoccupy Gaza has been described as deeply alarming by a senior UN official. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is reported to be pushing for an expansion of the military operation in the territory. Rachel Reeves has been warned tax rises will be needed this year to plug a £41 billion gap in the public finances. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research says the Chancellor is facing an impossible situation. LBC weather. Most areas fine and dry with sunny spells, cloud developing in the west through the afternoon, a high of 24 degrees.
This is LBC.
What makes Matchday? You know Maggie's cafe is the vibe.
Mate, piking all day, every day.
Mark, the cabbie, bigger fan than we are.
Banging out some Not the Top 20 on the way to the game.
It's a great podcast.
All the expert pundits down a dog and duck.
Oh, Kebab Palace, he gets the chilli garlic ratio spot on.
Match Day is about more than just the game. It's an experience shared with local businesses at the heart of every EFL club and community. That's why we're proud to support the businesses behind the badge. Sage, official accounting software partner of the EFL.
Body pain might not sound like this. Or this. But it might sound like this.
I'm fine.
Hiding your body pain behind a smile? Let us help. With up to 12 hours of uninterrupted muscle and joint pain relief. Voltarol, the joy of movement. Voltarol Joint and Back Pain Relief 2.3% gel contains diclofenac diethylammonium. Always read the label.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 5% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that dream holiday or a weekend getaway. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.89% gross. Terms apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. Drop up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours too. Inspect tire pressure and tread. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 10:35. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Alice has, well, I'd like to say she'd read my mind, but actually she's taken the mess and detritus sloshing around in my brain and actually managed to make some sense of it, because this fits with what I'm feeling, but I hadn't managed to articulate. They could both be right, James, to an extent, she writes. Those who have been misinformed and who care about being misinformed might change their minds if more background details about suspects in crimes is released. But those who follow the con artists and the con artists themselves will be fueled. I'm not sure sanity wins whatever you do. I also think that there is no happy conclusion here, because if you don't reveal more details of suspects, then people can claim cover-ups and cause more Southport-style riots, more Farage riots, the people claiming that there were cover-ups. They can claim it again. Anyone claiming there's a cover-up again, I would argue, is pretty close to publicly hoping that there is more violence. And then if you do release the details... Oh, man, this is it, isn't it? If you do release more details, then the consensus on this programme so far is that you could have 1,000 crimes committed by somebody born here and one committed by somebody not. 1,000 identical crimes... And it will still kick off when it is revealed that one of these crimes has been committed by somebody who was not born here or who even was seeking asylum. So let me read you two messages before we go to Jane, who's on the Wirral, and then Jen, who's in Attleborough. I read you two messages, one from Mick, one from Robert, that sit alongside each other almost perfectly. Mick writes, I think we already have the answer by observing what's happening in Epping, James. An asylum seeker is charged with a crime and word gets out, result riot. So I'm dead against it. And then Robert writes, it's also worth noting, backing up Mick's point, this is a text from a couple of weeks ago that I've dug out of the archive, Essex police crime statistics, which we've checked. In Epping and Ongar, there were 1,311 violence and sexual offences reported in the 12 months up to May of this year. How many of them prompted protests? So what is the message being sent to the 1,310 people accused of comparable crimes? Perhaps, in fact, hopefully not all as serious as the one in Epping, but some will be. What is the message being sent to those culprits? I'm slightly wary of white men demanding that we focus very, very heavily upon brown sex offenders, because you sort of wonder sometimes what it is they've got to hide. I'm thinking more about the people who turn up at the riots and then turn out to have records of their own, which contain the kind of crimes they're professing to be outraged by. Or, I suppose in the case of politicians, politicians who think you should keep it secret that a candidate has been incarcerated for battering a British woman, but somehow at the same time you can call for details of suspects who've been convicted of nothing to be released into the public arena. So there's no win here. We're almost asking, what's the least bad option? The world in which you don't release details? or the world in which you do? Because the people who want violence are probably going to get it either way. It's just a question of how much. Jane's on the Wirral. Jane, what do you think?
Well, I'm afraid Alice has just totally taken the rug out from me.
Oh, I hate
me,
it when that happens.
There's a heart and head answer. And
yes, you're right. Yes, you're right.
They're different. I spent the last week stood between protesters and counter-protesters trying to de-escalate situations.
Gosh.
And I've been told I don't care about the facts. I don't want them here.
Yeah.
I don't care anything. I just don't want them here. And you think, the facts ought to help, but they don't.
But remember, the people on the streets, and I mean, sadly, they're coming pretty close to getting public support now from people in traditional media. In fact, the woman locked up for inciting or trying to start pogroms does get championship hero status among some members of the traditional media. But you're describing an extremity. There must be some people. If you look at the statistics from yesterday, they believe things that are simply not true. So if they can be shown the truth, then their opinions will change. Not the people you're describing.
Yeah, but the people I'm describing were there also there with people who would describe themselves as concerned locals.
Yes,
who may be concerned locals, but quite a lot of them are still sort of displaying what I would sort of call casual racism.
And concerned about, in the case of Epping and Ongar, which isn't what you're referring to, more concerned about one incident. Okay, than they were about the other 1,310 incidents that happened in the same territory. It doesn't dilute their concern, it just makes it disproportionate.
That's absolutely right. And what we need, what we really need is a careful deprogramming policy. So let's call them concerned citizens. We're using language that is totally weaponized. They'll be calling undocumented, illegal, fighting-age men.
Yeah, invaders is a word that seems to have crossed their Rubicon now from being completely unacceptable to being acceptable.
Yeah, that one wasn't used yet.
Right.
But people who would not consider themselves slightly racist were using those words. Illegal when they clearly can't be illegal.
Undocumented
when by definition they're in the system, they are documented.
And their applications are overwhelmingly approved, which can't be done without information, and it's not going to be a perfect system. But the idea that you just get waved through without proving your case is palpably ridiculous. And we also know that people, again because of yesterday's polling, yesterday's research, people, even when they're talking about illegals, they've got a completely warped idea about how big that problem is. So just because the facts haven't worked yet doesn't mean they'll never work, does it?
No, but not without the deprogramming. You've got to work, and it's been implanted in people for so long. It's a big job to unpick.
So in the context of the short term, there's a great piece in the Times today by Daniel Finkelstein about the dangers of the short term, but he's writing about the Online Safety Act. He's not writing about this issue. He's just sort of reminding readers that the idea that you can judge a policy on day one or day two is really dangerous. But we live in the short term. We look at the long term. They are minded to introduce this. They are minded to tell the police. A lot of the police aren't keen, but they are minded to tell the police to reveal more details, more information about suspects, and do you think they should do it or not?
Yeah, but we could always do the way around and say, let's reveal a lot more information and put a lot more data and stories around convictions and try and tone down.
But you can't do that unless you've got your own media outlets.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
So I'm pushing you for an answer. In the world we inhabit, with the media we have and the various dishonest and disingenuous commentators and editors and columnists and politicians, should the government reveal or tell the police to reveal more details about suspects?
And the answer is, I don't know.
No, I don't know either.
I really don't know.
It's such a weird one. No one has challenged the analysis yet. No one has challenged the, and you're not either, the idea that this is what the tension is between the people who think that the facts will reduce the likelihood of violence and the people who think that they'll be able to use the quotes, facts, end quotes, to increase the likelihood of violence. Those are the two camps here. Pick a side. Thank you, Jane. From Jane to Jen in Attleborough. Jen, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello, Jane.
I mean, at first when I found out that Starmer had said that he was going to do this, and the announcement I heard was alongside Farage's name, so I was quite shocked.
Yes.
But then I gave my head a wobble and realised the reason why Starmer wanted it.
Mm.
And I'm a person that needs facts. And last week when you gave out that 1,311 statistic, it was amazing because it gives people who want that balance and to be able to have a good conversation about what's going on out there, it gives us information to use. I met somebody on holiday 2 weeks ago that came from Northern Ireland, and he said, in all seriousness to me, that they didn't have any rape in Northern Ireland. And I said to him, that can't be the case. So yeah. I Googled it, and I said to him, I'm really sorry, but have a look at this. And what the article I pulled up was showing that rape statistics are going up in Northern Ireland, and he looked at me square in the face and said, yes, but that's the immigrants. Now, for people like him, he's so far down the rabbit hole and he's been gaslit. I don't know what press he's reading. I don't think there's much hope for people like him. But I think that by providing a balance and providing the data, the loudest voices are being heard at the moment and the actual facts aren't out there. And I think that it might be possible to get through to some of the people who've been gaslit, but not all of them.
And is that better than nothing? Because you're going to... I mean, we're working on the presumption that it would reduce the likelihood of violence. Or maybe we're not. Maybe that's a red herring. It will reduce the level of misinformation being believed. It will turn down the temperature among perfectly ordinary people who wouldn't set fire to a hotel or wouldn't set fire to asylum seeker accommodation in a million years. But it would still be worth doing.
I absolutely think so. I can't see what harm it would do. And I think if we can change and get to some of the people's minds who've been gaslit, you know, and you said something a minute ago that I was going to say that, you know, out of 100, if I said to this guy I met last week on holiday, you know, that only one out of that 1,311, he'd say, well, one is too many because they're not focusing on the crime anymore. They're focusing on the race of the person.
Yeah, obviously, and increasingly explicitly.
Yes.
And I mean, the fellow you bumped into on holiday almost proving that point for you is I don't really care. And also the strange thing that people are increasingly emboldened to say is that they care more about a crime according to the status of the culprit or the person that's accused of it. The idea that if someone is attacked, it's worse. Or if someone is, God forbid, a victim of sexual assault or rape, it's somehow worse if the offender fits into a demographic I don't like than it would be if it fits into a demographic I do like. I find that...
Yes, because they don't belong here, James. We belong here.
That's the line they take. A brilliant caller suggested this to me a couple of weeks ago, is that you even have, when you look at the instances of violence... and you look at the records of some of the people jailed during the Farage riots last summer, they would probably fit into the category that a brilliant caller described a couple of weeks ago as not giving a monkeys about women, but just thinking that there are women, so we can be violent towards them or we can abuse them, but my goodness me, these incomers can't. And that's a hideous mindset, but one that is increasingly being mainstreamed almost, I think.
Conversations would be held more on other media, James. You talk about it all the time, and you know, I listen to you all the time, and I heard you yesterday and last week, and it's just that this needs to get out there.
And that's where you find yourself wondering why people don't. I mean, it's proven to be just as engaging or just as popular as doing the opposite, pretending that every brown person in the country is a criminal, or giving Nigel Farage a little massage every time he comes into the studio. There's no commercial reason to do it. You have to wonder whether the leanings of the people doing it tally more with the people looking for more violence than they do with the people praying that there isn't any, and that we all end up being a little bit more measured and a little bit more honest. 10:48 is the time. Thank you, Jen.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
I don't want to sit here day after day, week after week, talking about the UK as a declining nation. I don't want to do that. I live here too. I have family here too. But right now, it's really, really tough. We've talked endlessly, haven't we, about not just the millionaires leaving, but actually I think it's a lot of young people who are looking at their opportunities in the UK in the next 5 or 10 years and thinking, I'm out, and they're off.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
At SSE Energy Solutions, we know businesses are full of different kinds of energy.
Like your fourth coffee of the morning energy.
Your yes, chef energy. And even as per my last email energy. You can bring any energy you like to your business. But at SSE Energy Solutions, we bring simple, affordable energy. Choose SSE Energy Solutions, a different kind of energy.
All those glasses are a great choice. And now you can pick a free pair from our Boots range.
Free?
That's right.
What, free?
Absolutely. There's hundreds to choose from, too.
For free? Does the manager know?
I am the manager.
Oh, in that case, how do these look?
With buy one, get one free at Boots Opticians, everyone can save in style. Book an eye test today and see what's possible. Free Boots pair when you spend £150 on prescription glasses or sunglasses. Offer ends 23rd of September 2025. T's and C's apply.
You know, Kayak isn't just another flight comparison app. When you download the Kayak app, you download flight enlightenment. With Kayak, you see things others can't, like the latest great deals from both airlines and booking sites. You can filter your searches and set up price alerts so you... Not now.
Oh, sorry.
So you're notified when there's a price drop on the flights you want. See more, do more, save more with Kayak. You can do the gong now. Download the Kayak app today and go see for yourself.
So, where are we going?
You wanted to try something new? Well, we're here.
The Hyundai Electrifying Summer Event.
I booked a test drive in the all-new Insta online. It's the 2025 World Electric Vehicle winner and we save £500 if we order before the 31st of August.
Ooh, very stylish.
Oh, and it's Hyundai, by the way.
The Hyundai Electrifying Summer Event. Are you in? 18 plus UK retail customers only. Excludes Motability. Registered by 30th of September. T's and C's apply.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Top up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours too. I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 10:51 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. And we don't know. That seems to be the consensus. Will it be a good idea to release more information? I don't know where it goes back to. It possibly goes back to Magna Carta. Keeping as much detail from the public about someone accused of a crime until trial for fear of prejudicing a trial. Will it be a positive to release more or will it be a negative? And the two camps that are signed up for it obviously envision completely different outcomes. On the one hand, people who talk of cover-ups and the like are going to continue to foment anger and potentially violence, regardless of what the facts are. And on the other hand, some perhaps naive, but certainly well-meaning people think that the more facts you give people, the less likely they are to engage in or to subscribe to untruths and or engage in violent behaviour. And I still don't know. I'm not going to apologise for that because I think it is a reflection of the complexity of this case. I don't know. I think we're right to determine the two camps in the way that we have, but which camp is going to get what they want if this law changes, or if this guidance, it's only guidance, if it changes, I don't know. I suspect the answer will prove to be a bit of both, actually, is that some people will be able to use the rare instances of somebody coming from that background to foment violence, but you'll get less violence because they won't be able to use the instances of someone being accused of a crime who doesn't come from the demographics that they're currently most exercised by. It's a funny one, though. 10:53 is the time. Paul's in Bude in Cornwall. Paul, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi, James. You sort of summed up a bit what I was going to say there at the end, but...
Hate it when that happens.
Yeah, sadly. My opinion was that just nobody has the right to withhold fact from the public. So for me, it's always a case of if the person's white or brown, you just say it and people will react accordingly. You know, if that, but you,
that's never been the case.
Well, Farage was kicking off because he said that people weren't being told things, weren't they?
No, he was just asking questions, Paul.
Well, yeah, exactly. But if you start...
But we've never been told that until the police decide that it's time to... Oh, I see what you mean. So if it is the case that people are deliberately withholding the ethnicity of a suspect because they're worried about a violent reaction, they shouldn't be doing that. But
no, that's got to be wrong, isn't it?
Well, I don't know.
Who can withhold the truth?
I think I agree with you, but my view would always be, well, they're not going to be able to keep it secret. If you've got 1,000 people outside a police station who are going to set fire to it if the suspect is a Capricorn, and you decide not to tell them that the suspect is a Capricorn, but it comes out in court next Wednesday, surely in a utilitarian sense, that was the right thing to do.
Well, yeah, I don't know, but all I know is that...
No, hang on, someone... I'm sticking with this. I've got 1,000 people outside the police station in Bude who've been told...
So tell
that...
them what star sign they are then and have done with it.
But then they're going to set fire to the police station.
Well, no, because he might not be a Capricorn.
Yeah, but he is.
Oh, well, there you go.
So they
were right.
But then they'll set fire to the police station, whereas if you get them to disperse by not giving them any information at all, and then the truth will come out in court next week, what have we lost?
Disperse.
You've nailed it, mate.
Being on the phone to you, I'm more confused on the phone than I was when I'm listening.
It's funny that. But that is the entire point, is that you're existing in an intellectual universe rather than the universe of flesh and blood. There are 1,000 people baying for blood because they think that somebody is demographic X.
Yeah.
They would not be baying for blood if he was demographic Y. So the facts are not objective. The facts are biased. Mm. They're going to react very differently if it's Paul in Bude from how they are if it's someone who just got off
a... Yeah, I appreciate that.
In order to ensure that they don't set fire to the police station and that the bloke inside gets a fair trial, you don't reveal the information that night. That's the argument. I don't know that I agree with it, but that is...
No, I just think it's difficult. Once you start withholding stuff, who decides what you can withhold and what you can't? You know, who has the right to not tell me something if you know?
Well, for a start, the person who's trying to keep you alive.
Well, yeah.
Or the person who's trying to keep me alive.
Mm.
Or the person who's trying to stop that.
Now than I was when I thought I knew what I was talking about when I started this call.
Welcome to my world, Paul. Welcome to my world. I think I know what I'm talking about at 10 o'clock every morning. Sometimes I get to as far in as 20 past without it all beginning to fall apart. Thank you. I think it's more Bude. How do you pronounce your town?
Well, if you've lived there long enough, you say Bude.
Oh, you do? That's what I thought. Yeah, I'm getting picked up, but I went halfway. Some people think it's an even longer U. Bude. Bude in Cornwall. Thank you, Paul. We'll talk again, I hope. 10:56 is the time. Sarah is in Ipswich. Sarah, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi. Good morning. A little bit nervous. First-time caller.
It's only me, Sarah.
I know.
Go on.
It was from what you were talking about earlier. I wanted to kind of take it back a little bit because I think we've got to a point where there has been an agenda of certain political figures to other people. By othering people and by dehumanising people, therefore we see them differently. I was saying to your producer that myself and my husband have fostered 3 young asylum seekers from age 14. So if anybody comes at me and says, well, you wouldn't have them in your house, yes, I would.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. They were polite. We keep in touch with them. They're amazing. We've also worked with asylum seekers and refugees. And I think what has happened, people don't see the emotion and the psychology. They don't see them as people. And because of that, there's no point in attacking people on the right and saying you're stupid, you're this, that and the other. It's gone past that.
Yes.
There was just no point to it. You need to come at it from an emotional angle. And the people that I've seen protesting at these hotels, and we supported a lot of people in hotels, we started working with asylum seekers back in 2015 when lots of Syrian families came over. And I see all of these things in the news, and I know these things aren't true, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I say anything on social media. People don't want to know. They'll just laugh. It's gone past all of that. So I think we need to put some kind of emotional connection.
It's the second person, so stories. But the problem with that, and I'm only interrupting you partly because I find it very hard not to, but on this occasion we are quite tight for the news.
Sure.
The power of the story is going to be determined in large part by the size of the platform and where will you hear those stories? That's the problem, isn't it? If God forbid the young lads that you looked after had hurt you or stolen from you, it would be headline news. But the fact that they were lovely and you continue to be close and keep tabs on each other and they presumably feel a great debt of gratitude to you, that's dog bites man.
Yeah, and that's the sad thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
If something did happen, of course, it would be. But I think I just want to put it out there that these are people. These are people, and by dehumanising, othering, it makes it so easy.
We never focus on the whiteness of a suspect with the same prominence that we do on other ethnicities, which is part of the othering process, the low-level othering, the entry-level othering that you describe. And this isn't a criticism by any stretch of the imagination. I don't know, and you may not know either, whether you are supportive or unsupportive of the idea under discussion, the idea of giving the public more on the background of suspects.
I spoke to your producer about this when she asked me, and my response was, what agenda is it feeding into? How did we get to this point that we need to now know that? Who wants to know this? Because it seems to
have been... Well, it's lies, isn't it, about two-tier justice or about the criminal justice system being so... And that takes us back to the original problem, is that can you actually appease people who are... in the business of disseminating dangerous and insightful lies.
Exactly. And it's so difficult. We're so up against it, and it's hard work, and it's heartbreaking. I don't know where we go from here, but
that's fine.
I hope... Yeah.
Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I just wish that people would... think more about things instead of just. I know.
Me too. I'm laughing affectionately and in full agreement. I hope it came across that way on the phone. I'm laughing wistfully, almost. If people would just think more about things, those are the two points of the discussion. An earlier caller saying it was Andrew in Penzance, actually a nice representation for East Anglia and for Cornwall today in the first hour. Just saying that I'm. I don't think he used the word naive, but expecting facts to do more work than they're capable of doing. And Sarah. Mustering under my standard on the idea that if only people would think more, they wouldn't behave in the ways that they behave. 1 minute after 11 is the time.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is holding talks with the Russian President, Vladimir Putin. They are discussing efforts to end the war in Ukraine, days before Mr. Trump's deadline for Moscow to reach a peace deal. Washington has threatened severe tariffs and other penalties if the fighting doesn't stop. Sir Tony Brenton is a former British ambassador to Russia.
What is interesting is that Witkoff is there, as I understand it, at Russia's request, and that he's been so quickly met by Putin, which is a sign that the Russians take this meeting really seriously. And I suspect that the Russians are uncomfortable with the thought that Trump has a deadline of Friday before imposing more sanctions on Russia.
Israel's defense minister has insisted the military will follow the government's orders in Gaza. It follows reports the IDF's chief of staff is opposed to a potential plan for a total occupation of the territory. The country's security cabinet is due to meet this week. New figures show someone has their phone stolen in Westminster every 15 minutes. That's the equivalent of 100 phones taken in the London borough every day, many snatched by e-bike riders. These people have been speaking to LBC on Oxford Street.
We're window cleaners round here, so we see it day in and day out. On the other hand, people really need to take more care.
One every 15 minutes in a dense populated city. So I think it's down to individuals to think a little bit more about it.
And it does make me concerned to take my phone out and use it in public.
The Metropolitan Police says it's using extra patrols and tracking technology to tackle the issue. The Conservatives have accused Labour of mismanaging the economy after a fresh warning about tax rises. An independent think tank has warned there is a £41 billion shortfall in Rachel Reeves' self-imposed borrowing rules. NYSA has recommended moderate tax increases in the budget this autumn. Santander is facing calls from ministers to scrap its plans to charge some small businesses for their banking. The lender had previously promised to keep it free forever. It's blamed a significant change in the business banking landscape for the new policy. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 91.60. That's up 17. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 14. LBC weather. Most places fine with some sunny spells. Cloud increasing in the west later in the afternoon. A high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Five minutes after 11 is the time. I don't know quite how to approach this story. Well, I do. I know exactly how to approach it, but I want to get the tone 100% right, because I am supremely unsurprised by this statistic. I'm so supremely unsurprised by it. I'm not even sure why it's news, but I do understand why it is. Parents who ridicule, threaten, or humiliate their children risk leaving them with a 64% higher chance of having poor mental health as an adult. A reduction in childhood physical abuse experienced among the participants in this research went hand in hand with an increase in verbal abuse. I've wondered about this a lot, because in the context of therapy, the thing you realise is that the greatest lie human beings tell themselves, you know what it is, right? You know what I'm going to say. And you start telling yourself this lie at a really early age. Probably because we are inherently aware of the fact that verbal abuse is really damaging, linked to ill health later in life. Can you work out what the lie is? It's pretty obvious. One of the great lies that we tell, and you don't even know it's a lie. When you're young, it feels like armor. When you're young, it feels like a form of protection. It's almost as if you're trying to persuade yourself that you're not in pain when you are. So you say to yourself, that mantra of playgrounds through the ages. I don't imagine young people say it now because it all sounds a little bit out of date. But sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. You tell yourself that when you're a child. Sticks and stones may break my bones. Someone says something horrible to you and it's hurting, so you need to come back. Because if it wasn't hurting, you probably wouldn't need to come back. You go, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And, spoiler alert, they do. This, however, is not about playgrounds. This is exclusive to parental relations. If you are lucky enough to have had or to still have loving parents, these stories are somehow impenetrable. The worst thing you can do if you are lucky enough, and I think it is largely luck, isn't it? If you are lucky enough not to have suffered verbal abuse from your parents, the worst thing you can do is minimise the experiences of people who did, or people who are, or people who have. Because it's not even, it didn't do me any harm territory, which was the second most popular answer to my question of which lie that we tell ourselves as children is the biggest. I'd say roughly 90% of you went for sticks and stones, but a couple went for never did me any harm. So that's the other form of armour. I mean, it's the same, actually, in a way, it's the same form of armour, claiming that I'm not in pain. 'Tis but a scratch. 'Tis a flesh wound. But it's not exactly the same, because quite often the people reaching, well, obviously, the people reaching for the never did me any harm are telling people currently being harmed that they're not really being harmed. I used to be terrible for this. Absolutely terrible. I used to do it in the context of corporal punishment, actual physical abuse by adults of children, by teachers at my second school. Actually, there was a little bit of corporal punishment at my first school as well. That was done by nuns. Didn't hurt anywhere near as much as when it was done by grown men. And you'd say, never did me any harm. So I would sit here. I don't know if it was on this job, but certainly on previous jobs, I would sit here and tell you that corporal punishment there was a time and a place for it. It was the only language that some children understood. I can't believe this now. I genuinely can't believe it. I don't know what happened to my brain. Well, I do, because I've worked it out in therapy. I was doing the, it never did me any harm. But it did. And yet you protect yourself from the harm that it's done by A, convincing yourself that it didn't hurt or that it hasn't lingered or that you're not harmed, and B, and this is where it gets dangerous, telling other people that the harm being done to them doesn't really hurt, that they're not actually suffering. Because, look, it didn't do me any harm. But it did. Lots. It takes away your trust in adults. It shakes the foundations of your very world. And I think there's a tendency to think that physical abuse is worse than verbal. I wonder if it's actually the other way around. I don't want to have a competition. This isn't top trumps of childhood trauma. But in some ways, you'd rather have a slap than, certainly if it was one-off formal punishment, which I passionately oppose, by the way, but fully accept that parents in the 1970s and 80s had completely different sensibilities and outlooks and experiences. But if you, for example, stole a pound note out of your mum's purse and you knew when you were caught that meant you were going to get your bottom smacked or a hairbrush across the back of your legs, that was a fairly simple to understand relationship between actions and consequences, also with an air of deterrent built in. What would you choose? That or actual constant and inconsistent? So some days mum would be nice to you, other days she'd be horrible. I think that would be much worse. I stress again, I don't want to do a top trumps of childhood trauma, but I do want to know what it's like. And it has to be parents, okay? It has to be parents. Parents who ridicule, threaten, or humiliate their children. You may not know what impact it's had upon you later in life. You won't be able to draw a diagram or a graph. We'll never be able to pin down precisely how far these ripples reach. You may not even, and if you're in this category, I don't know whether you should be thanking me or I should be apologising to you. You may not even have thought about it before. But if you have poor mental health, if you have low mental well-being, if you suffer perhaps from confidence issues or you know, how much you like yourself, self-care issues, then it is clear, and correlation is not causation, of course, but if you had no experience of abuse during childhood, you would be about 16% likelihood of suffering, enduring low mental well-being. It goes up to 24 for verbal, which is slightly higher than physical. Now, verbal abuse potentially, under the context of this research, does more long-term harm to your mental health than physical abuse. It's not a stress again, it's not a competition and it's not a comparison. And in fact, to that end, people who suffer both physical and verbal have by far the highest, or by some distance, the highest prevalence of low mental well-being. I wonder now, what's it like to process the verbal abuse in the way that I have processed? Well, it wasn't my mum and dad, so it's not the same, but you know, I've made this journey from insisting very loudly that it didn't do me any harm to recognising the enormous harm that it did to me to be beaten quite regularly as a teenage boy, as a 11, 12, 13-year-old. What damage does it do? What sort of damage does the verbal abuse do? And when did you realise? 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. And I'll tell you what else I'd like to know, if you're in the mood to tell me. How looked after are you now? What's it like to recognise the level of trauma delivered by verbal abuse from your own mum or your own dad? Who takes that seriously? What happened? I mean, do they apologise? I imagine it's a rock that gets thrown into a pool. Parental verbal, for the purposes of this conversation, not physical, but it's not a distinction I'm going to police completely, especially not if you've endured both. Imagine it's a rock that we lob into a pool. I have no idea how far those ripples reach. I have no idea what other people think when you tell them about those ripples. I've got no idea what links you can see between big you now and what they did to little you then. And I also recognise that you might still, in fact, you hopefully still do love the bones of your parents. And there might be, as with smacking, an argument that they had no idea the damage they were doing back in the day when they engaged in behaviours that would now qualify as verbal abuse, but perhaps didn't then. There's a phrase that therapists use, which is, it gets more powerful the longer that you've known it. It really does. And the phrase is that the body keeps the score. And it's not about physical scars. It's about mental scars. And it's hard to think of anything more likely to inflict a mental scar, isn't it, than a parent who betrays that most basic tenet of the parental relationship, who either denies you unconditional love or who actually makes you feel worse than you did before they intervened in that moment. So what is it like as an adult? How do you process, describe, and of course remember verbal abuse you received from a parent when you were a child? Because there's no way this isn't true, is there? There's no earthly way that being exposed to verbal abuse from the person you're supposed to get the most love from, and some days I imagine you did, but to get the verbal abuse from them. Describe those scars, if you can, if that doesn't sound voyeuristic. I don't know quite what the word I'm looking for is. We do this stuff together quite a lot, and I think it's really important because people who will never ring a radio show in a million years will hear you tell your story, and they will immediately feel less alone and better. 0345 6060973 is the number you need. Why are you absolutely certain that this research linking verbal abuse from a parent to ill health later in life is completely copper-bottomed?
LBC.
All those glasses are a great choice. And now you can pick a free pair from our Boots range.
Free?
That's right.
What, free?
Absolutely. There's hundreds to choose from, too.
For free? Does the manager know?
I am the manager.
Oh, in that case, how do these look?
With buy one, get one free at Boots Opticians, everyone can save in style. Book an eye test today and see what's possible. Free Boots pair when you spend £150 on prescription glasses or sunglasses. Offer ends 23rd of September 2025. T's and C's apply.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, drop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It's 18 minutes after 11, and Something just got me right in the feels. I often get, I've told you before, that if you're going to ask me not to use your name, you must put it at the top of the message, because I sometimes start reading them and get to the bottom and realise that I've already said your name and you at the bottom of the message asked me not to. But you've never, ever, in fact, we've seen so many messages with please don't use my name at the top. Just on this simple question of the damage that verbal abuse can do to a child when that abuse comes from parents. I've never seen the phrase, please don't use my name, appear like ping, 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 ping at the top of the inbox. And I will read you some of those when we've had a chance to have a proper look at them. Karen is in Coventry to kick off this conversation. Karen, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Thank you for taking my call. As always, great show. So, yeah, I think the subject about mental health is something which is very close to me, both at a personal and a sort of professional level as well. So I have sort of suffered verbal abuse as a child and even as an adult. It's predominantly come from one parent, which is my mum. I've always kind of been expected to be a high achiever from when I was a very, very young age. There's always been this expectation that I need to be a high achiever. And I've sort of struggled with anxiety issues as well for the best part of my life, which have now made more sense to me as an adult after going through a process of seeking help for it.
Because you could never live up to your parents or your mum's expectations, or she made such a meal of telling you that you were a failure?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. I don't know if, I mean, it wouldn't really be an example in childhood, but right. When I was at medical school, I remember I had an exam when I was at medical school. I think it was in my final year of medical school, and I passed the exam. But I didn't get the mark that I kind of was hoping for. And then when I came home and I told my parents I'd passed the exam, the amount of abuse and stick that I got from my mum, just because I didn't get a particularly high mark in one exam, was just...
I mean, this would be vicious, would it? Because you might see disappointment in your mum's face, or you might say, I got a B, and she goes, oh, you didn't get an A. And that is actually quite cruel in the great scheme of things, but it's not abusive.
Yeah, but I think it would really, the use, the way that, you know, she would go about doing it, it would really, I mean, I already struggle with my confidence.
Yeah.
So for me, that's
the last thing you need, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was trying to explain to her that, Mum, you know, medical school is not easy, the exams are difficult, and sometimes just getting a pass is a good place to be, because they do test you. But, you know, trying to get that message across to her and just telling her I'm trying my best has just never been good enough.
When did it start?
Since I was younger, but I think it exacerbated after my parents had my brother. So there's quite a big age gap between me and my brother, about sort of 10 years between us. And then after that, I feel like, I mean, this is what I felt, but then some of the people that are quite close to us as well have also felt this, that there's been a little bit of a discrepancy in the way that my mum maybe treats me and my brother. She's always been a lot harsher with me, and I think it's, you know, affected my confidence.
And if, I mean, I don't know that we can ever prove these things. You can work them out in therapy, and you can do the work, as it were, but how would we draw the line? I hesitate to ask you this question because it might be a bit cruel, but who would you be if your mum hadn't treated you like that? Or how would you be?
I think I'd still probably have some of the challenges that I have.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, some of the difficulties that I have come from the fact that I've got ADHD. I think what might have been better is my confidence levels might have been a bit better if I had that encouragement and more sort of support. Maybe I wouldn't have been, I might have been able to cope better with sort of the low confidence, but...
It's validation, isn't it? And feeling $1 million. And if you can't feel that in your relationship with your own mum, you're unlikely to achieve those levels in your sort of internal dialogues, your relationship with yourself. Karen, thank you, mate.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
I used to get this really wrong, you know. You just made me think about this. In that I I kind of got turned into a show-off by the opposite of what Karen describes, being constantly bigged up and encouraged and loved and all those kind of things. There's a danger that it could turn you into somebody who thinks they are the sort of cock of the walk. And then you sort of get a little bit older and you think, well, did I really think I was the cock of the walk, or was I insecure? There's so much stuff you can dig into. Does the fact that I was adopted mean that I spent my life demanding praise and demanding approval? And I'm not mentioning that because it's particularly interesting. I'm just showing you that the roots back to childhood to explain adult behaviour or adolescent behaviour are sometimes a lot more complicated than even we realise. Amy's in West Calder. Amy, what would you like to say?
Hi there, James.
Hey, Amy.
I just recently lost my dad. We had a very turbulent kind of relationship growing up. I lost my mum when I was 10, and my dad was kind of my rock for a long time.
Yeah.
But and a lot of things said to me growing up that I even now still struggle with. He used to call me fatty.
Oh.
And, you know, I didn't eat at school properly because I thought, yes, I was fat. And a lot of my friends obviously wouldn't have known this. And I think one of the worst things he ever said to me, and I still carry it now, was I was helping him with the kitchen.
Mm.
We're putting in new worktops. And I didn't understand what he was trying to explain. And the worktop was heavy. And he basically turned around to me and said, oh, a geriatric earthworm's got more effing brains. And before my dad passed, weeks before, we'd had a kind of one-to-one, and yeah. I brought a lot of things up with him. And he basically told me that I had pig's dirt for brains, and I stormed out.
Even as an adult, he went back to the language of abuse.
Yeah.
Did he say it? And I don't know if this matters, Amy, so forgive me if my curiosity is leading me towards crassness, but would he have claimed that he was bantering with you? I mean, I know it doesn't matter in terms of how it lands, or was he obviously being vicious and unkind?
I think he probably would have seen it as, he would have told me I was just being too overly sensitive.
There it is.
And, you know, if I'd asked for an apology, I would never have got it.
No.
I think he kind of half-heartedly apologised after it, because something else had happened. My dad wasn't well, but I would never have heard the words, I'm sorry. I would never have heard that from him.
How important would that have been to you?
It would have meant everything to me.
Why?
Just to know that maybe he said it in the heat of the moment and he didn't mean it. And yeah. I feel like now that he's gone, we did love each other. The love was there.
Of course.
But I needed him to know how much that hurts me, and it still does.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I have two brothers, one of which, my eldest brother, will never, ever see the wrong in it. He's like, oh, Dad was Dad.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm going to carry that, and I'm never, ever going to be able to get past it, and I struggle with it.
You could get past it.
Yeah.
You may not feel like it, but we can, and you can never get fully over it, but you can get past it. Who looked after 12-year-old you?
Well, this is where it's hard, because my dad looked after me and my brothers. He gave up everything to look after us.
But who looked after you when you were suffering from what your dad had said and done to you?
Nobody.
Exactly. Nobody looked after you. But that doesn't have to be true now.
No.
You can look after you. You can tell that 12-year-old girl that she's not fat and she's not stupid. And your dad was, in many ways, a good man, but he got that stuff horribly, horribly wrong. It's just that first step on the road to self-care is for big you, grown-up you, to tell little you that you're none of the things that your dad said that you were, and that you're safe now.
Yeah. I'm never going to hear it. It would just have been nice for him to say.
Of course it would. Of course it would. But please don't think that it is meaningless when you hear it from yourself.
Yeah.
I promise you. I mean, I swear, listen, 10 years ago, if this conversation was the other way around, and you were telling me to talk to little me, I'd have thought you were bonkers. And I think you might think I'm a bit bonkers. But You're not supposed to agree, Amy. But I just want to. That's a tiny little thing I can give you is the knowledge that sometimes the grown up version of a human being can provide the care for the lost little version that they didn't get at the time. And the crucial point is that they deserved it. You deserved to be better looked after back then.
I think you just lacked the emotional side of him that kind of wasn't there. Yeah. And, there were so many good times with him. I don't want to paint him as this horrible person.
You haven't. I mean, this is the point, really, about inconsistency and that you would receive love, but you'd also receive these barbed wire wrapped brick bats that you completely didn't deserve. And of course, as a child, you can't process that. You can't do that. And you're still a child when you talk about this. You're still struggling to process how this man that I love and who loves me could have caused me so much pain. But the crucial word in that sentence is process. Process.
Yeah.
Take care, won't you?
Thank you, James. Thank you.
It's such a fascinating and important subject. Here's an interesting one from Peter. Why do you put on a silly patronising voice? It comes across as fake. It's all about tone, Peter. So, unfortunately, and this might sound a little bit cruel, but when you were a child and you were in pain, your parents obviously didn't talk to you in a loving and caring voice. They didn't try and change the cadence of their language. They didn't try and reach you with softness and kindness. So, of course, if you're discussing incredibly sensitive issues with somebody, you will change your voice. But if no one ever did that for you when you were in pain, you're going to project, you're going to push back, and you're going to feel whatever weird thing it is that you're feeling when you pick up your phone and send in a message like that while listening to a conversation like Amy. So I'm using the same voice for you because you're not aware of the pain that has prompted you to do that, whereas Amy is aware of the pain that her father caused her, and my sympathy for both of you explains why obviously I'm going to use a different tone when I talk to two suffering people than I would if, for example, we were talking about allotments or immigration. I really hope that helps, mate. I really do. 11:30 is the time. Thomas Watts has your headlines.
Vladimir Putin has held talks with President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff in Moscow. The US has a deadline of Friday for Russia to reach a peace deal with Ukraine or face severe economic penalties. Israel's defense minister has insisted the IDF will follow the government's orders on its operations in Gaza. It follows reports of opposition from senior military officials over a potential expansion of the campaign. A leading think tank has warned Rachel Reeves is facing a £41 billion shortfall in meeting her fiscal rules. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research says there will have to be moderate but sustained tax rises this year. LBC weather, most areas fine and dry with sunny spells, cloud increasing in some western areas later, a high of 24 degrees.
The all-new LBC app. News your way. Download it for free from the App Store. This is LBC.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
But 9.13% fixed annual return with Cufflink. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest, property-backed from £500. Hard not to agree. Visit cufflink.com. That's Cufflink. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to auto-invest and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA. Visit cufflink.com for full T's and C's.
What makes match day? You know Maggie's cap is the vibe.
Mate, piking all day, every day.
Mark, the cabbie, bigger fan than we are.
Banging out some Not the Top 20 on the way to the games.
It's a great podcast.
All the expert pundits down the dog and duck.
Oh, Kebab Palace, he gets the chili-garlic ratio spot on.
Match day is about more than just the game. It's an experience shared with local businesses at the heart of every EFL club and community. That's why we're proud to support the businesses behind the badge. Sage, official accounting software partner of the EFL.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, drop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC with James O'Brien. Text 84850.
33 minutes after 11 is the time, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where it's a remarkable response, as perhaps you would expect, but the idea that anyone would be surprised to discover that childhood verbal abuse can be linked to ill health later in life is remarkable. I'm sure it's not the first time that this link has been described in the news, but it's in almost every news outlet today, and it is, for many people listening to this, a statement of the bleeding obvious, and for many other people, it's almost a sort of vindication of their adult experiences being traceable back to their childhood experiences. One of the authors of the report says, "Our study reveals that degrading, humiliating, and abusive language directed at children can have long-term mental health impacts, at least as severe as those associated with physical abuse. And this isn't a competition or a contest, but our society has happily advanced to a place where we are no longer as comfortable with physical abuse of children, or parental discipline, as some people used to call it, perhaps still do. That's all we're pointing out, is that it would be good, in much the same way that mental health has recently, happily, still a long way to go, been recognised as being as debilitating and as serious as physical health. So with verbal abuse and physical abuse. I said I would do this, and I've been a bit inundated, so there's no way that I'm going to be able to read all of them out. But here is a small selection of messages that begin. And the reason why I point to the fact that they begin with the words, "Please don't use my name," is because that's shame. And that's why I tried to explain to Amy in my patronising voice. I tried to explain that you shouldn't be feeling shame about that. Someone should have looked after you, but you can't just order people to stop feeling shame. None of us can be ordered to stop feeling shame. Now I need to be really careful on the names, because the last thing I want to do is disobey that instruction, that request. I don't want to go into details about what my parents said to me. I simply can't. But what it resulted in was, the second that I saw an exit, I ran into an abusive relationship because it was better than the one I was running away from. Please don't say my name. I don't know if I'll be able to listen to your show for the next hour. I was smacked growing up. My bedroom door had punch and kick marks in it from when my dad was angry. I still flinch if he raises a hand near me, but the verbal, never being good enough abuse I got growing up from him was the worst. I can't accept anything I do now is enough. I hate praise from anyone. I don't trust people from the outset. Constantly fear that I will mess up and push people away. The scary thing is that I love my dad, and I fear properly dealing with the trauma might make me lose these feelings." Oh, mate. "And I don't know if I should get help or not. It was often in our family, and I think it stays with you. Always feeling lesser in some way. Hi, James, please don't use my name. I've been writing a memoir, and yesterday I was writing about conflict with my late dad. He was mocking me for singing along to my George Michael CD, and with venom, by proxy, calling me a..." And there's a couple of words here that are controversial, but I can say them in this context. "He called me a pufter and a shirtlifter, terms I was barely able to understand at the time, when I was genuinely trying to understand my own sexuality. Only as I wrote did I realise how much I'd blocked out. It came flooding back like a tidal wave and totally overwhelmed me. And this, please don't use my name. I'd like to say that tone of voice is really important when speaking to your kids." And this came, I should add, just before I read out the message that I read out just before the news, and it was quite helpful in reminding me about some of the points where within. "Tone of voice is really important when speaking to your kids. I'm 22 now, and all my life my dad has spoken to me like I'm an idiot, like he doesn't trust me, like I'm less than him. I was petrified of him. Experiencing that as a child filled me with anxiety and stress as a teenager and led me to get counselling without my parents knowing. I can barely look my dad in the eyes and he acts as if nothing was ever wrong. I am so sorry to read that. I really am. And I know I can't read your name and I won't. Don't worry, please. But goodness me, that is... At 22, to have that clarity of thought in one way is a good thing, because it's better than wrestling with the unexamined, but goodness me, it's also a horrible thing to have had done to you. Alice is in Lincoln. Alice, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello,
thank
Alice.
You for taking my call.
You're
I spoke
welcome.
To you a little while ago about young people's mental health.
Oh, yes.
So thank you for having me on again.
You work in the field.
So I sort of come at this from two points of view, because I was subject to verbal abuse growing up, as well as some other kinds of abuse, but I've also done quite a lot of work in the area, so I understand some of the mechanisms and things that are at play here.
So
for my personal side, I had things like everyone in the family was UFing this, UFing that. You would be screamed at all of a sudden for no reason.
Yikes.
They're my children, I'll kill them if I want to. You know, just a lot of things that are very scary, as well as the kind of absences where someone's just casually a bit cruel, like, oh, that would look lovely if you just lost half a stone. Other person you were standing next to was really good. Those kinds of things. So a kind of quite a spread of it. I also have rheumatoid arthritis, and I raise this because there is quite significant evidence that verbal and psychological abuse can lead to a massive increase in autoimmune diseases. And what it does is, particularly when you're a child, you don't necessarily register the threat of a parent, and it's specifically sort of primary carers, making verbal threats or physical threats, because at those ages, they're both existential.
Yes.
And what happens is your body goes, it responds as if it's going into fight or flight, which includes activating the immune system. And if that is chronic, it kind of messes up the immune system because it's being activated all the time. So you get people getting much more autoimmune disease later on in life, and this then leads to things like lung disease because they're increased. And it all comes out of research around something called adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah, ACEs.
Yeah, which is a wonderful set of research and well worth looking into. But in essence, what it's doing short term, yeah, you know, a physical act can be lethal instantly, and I think that's why it's often prioritised. But long term, definitely psychological, emotional, verbal abuse can definitely be as bad or worse than physical abuse.
I find what you describe completely compelling. I don't know if people need help. Think of an engine or something like that, and the strains that are placed on an engine at a very early stage, and the fact that it's not properly cared for, and it's spending far too long at full speed, and it's not got its oil changed, and you know, the body is an engine that is being affected by external non-physical factors, but they're having a physical impact on the on what is actually going on. And then you get older, and the consequences of that that treatment, that abuse, whatever you want to call it, it become clearer as you get older. And I suppose part of the problem is it's not going to be a straight line, is it? Not everybody who experienced what you experienced is going to end up with rheumatoid arthritis any more than everybody who smoked is going to end up with lung cancer. But to me, the lines are clear. And I remember from the last time I spoke to you that you work in this field now. So I'm going to nudge you, if I may, towards slightly happier territory about how you can, because I think Amy in particular would like to hear about how you can, quote, get over, end quote, some of these experiences and some of these traumas.
Yeah. So if you're dealing with children, if you look at ACEs research, there's something called an always available adult. And this is a person who is essentially modelling positive behaviours. So, and it you know, ideally it's someone very close to the child or young person, but it could be a teacher. I remember police officers being mentioned. It's basically someone who's going to say to them, what you're experiencing is not okay and it's not your fault. Because at the heart of a lot of it, particularly if the abuse started young, children internalize it and they believe they are responsible for it. And often that is part of the abusive process, part of the grooming process. In terms of long-term care, obviously there's support through NHS, through medical services, and more the treatments are geared towards this kind of thing. You know, you mentioned The Body Keeps the Score earlier, which is the title of a book by a really incredible writer who was involved in the development of the PTSD diagnosis. Now, he and several of his colleagues have said this kind of abuse can actually be harder to treat than war veterans' PTSD.
Wow.
It can be very difficult.
I suppose, simplistically, because if you go to war, you're expecting the other lot to take pot shots at you. But if you're asleep in your bed at home, you're not expecting the people supposed charged with providing nesting and nurture to make you feel awful.
Yes, and it's also often soldiers have had this is a wild generalization, I know, but if you've had a relatively healthy upbringing to the point you join the army, you've got a solid base and you've got a solid developmental point to go back to. Mm. Whereas if you've had it all through your childhood, it's kind of knotted in with your whole life and your whole way of understanding. But there are some phenomenal sort of formal treatments, things like trauma-focused CBT, EMDR has fantastic results and it's not intrusive and it doesn't require drugs. But I would also point towards things like peer support. So I work with a local peer support group who've supported me through suicide attempts and all kinds of difficulty, and it's been life-changing. And I actually spoke to a clinical lead on mental health about what we can do, and he talked so passionately about what we can do for each other. So for men listening, he was talking about things like what football teams can do, and having a place to talk about these issues just for men in a space that's prioritised for men.
What a wonderful thing. I'm conscious of the time, and I could listen to you all day because you're an advocate and you've got a slightly evangelical air to you as well, which must be very helpful in your work. But I don't want Amy to feel bad about this, but when she says, I'll never get over it, is it wrong to say you will get over bits of it? You can actually get over bits of this with the kind of help and treatment that you're describing.
I think, funnily, listening to Amy, my dad died last year, I had similar difficulties. I don't think you get over it. What I do is I think you're right to say you process it and you reframe it.
Yes.
And it's finding that kindness for yourself and recognizing that they are a human who was limited and doing what they could do, and so are you, and that's okay. And you can do your best. You can acknowledge that they didn't achieve it, they did things wrong, but it's not your fault.
And that takes us back to one of my anonymous messages, worrying that if he or she did the work, then it might remove the love that they want to continue feeling for their father. You're a legend, Alice. You must be brilliant at what you do. I'm going to provide one footnote, and one footnote only, which is EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. There's a kind of version of it as well, which is sometimes known as brain spotting. It's the maddest therapy. I think Prince Harry has done it, and I'm not really qualified to explain what it is or indeed how it works, but it is a form of recovery. It's to help you recover from trauma and specific, very specific life experiences. It is something that we need a lot more of, in my view, in this country. It's a treatment for PTSD as well, post-traumatic stress disorder. Alice, thank you. It's 11:47.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast on LBC.
Reports of anti-Semitic incidents surged the day after Bob Villain's Glastonbury set, according to a charity that monitors anti-Semitism. Culture, media and sports secretary Lisa Nanny joining us on the show. You'll be aware of the Community Security Trust. It's a Jewish security organisation. They've reported a surge of anti-Semitic incidents the day after the Bob Villain Glastonbury concert, which was broadcast on the BBC. What progress have you made in conversations with the Director General, Tim Davey?
So I've had a meeting and several discussions with both the Director General and the Chair of the Board. They are making a whole series of changes in relation to that.
Are you confident something like this would never happen again, Secretary of State?
I can't say that I'm currently confident about that.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crispin with Walker's. Delicious.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
OK.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Have I won a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6. T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
At TfO, we're opening up more of London for everyone with step-free access. We're continuing to improve accessibility at many of our stations, and now over 200 stations and counting have step-free access, including the entire Elizabeth Line, DLR and all tram stops. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
Book a free hearing test today at bootshearingcare.com and save up to £300 with our free technology upgrade. Boots, with you for life. T's and C's apply. See website for details.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
It is 9 minutes to 12, so I'm reading as many of the messages that I can coming into the studio. I won't be able to read them all out loud. I'll read this one out from Gareth, because it's on a rather lighter note. James, I love you, but your memory is shocking. You've forgotten to finish your middle-class brown sauce anecdote that you started yesterday. There's a reason to keep listening, no? Who here wouldn't love a middle-class brown sauce anecdote? All right, I'll try. Put your hands down. You're supposed to be my colleagues. I'll try to remember to share that one before close of play today. But I want to do something a little bit different first, if I may. Amy and Alice both lost their fathers relatively recently. And I was contacted recently by the son and daughter of, well, by two people who've also recently lost their father. Thea and Phil got in touch. And you know their dad. Or you knew their dad, and you will, like me, have valued his contributions to this programme on a level that was, well, rare to the point of unique. He was known to you and to me as Anthony in Bletchley Park, and his contributions on issues of international relations and others were one of the reasons why I started boasting about presenting the kind of radio show that got callers of a higher calibre than other radio shows had guests who were actually booked by producers. Anthony, in many ways, was the patron saint of that boast. His full title was Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Franks OBE, but I didn't know that when we made our acquaintance. And he passed away recently after a short illness, and I wanted to pay tribute to him and send my love to his children, because it was such an honour to have his contributions to this programme. I've subsequently discovered something that I suspected, and if you listen to the calls that I'm thinking of, then you will know what I am talking about. But I've subsequently discovered that he was supremely well qualified to comment on all of the subjects that he spoke to us about, and spoke 8 languages fluently, classical and modern Arabic. He believed that to understand a person and what they might be facing in life, you must speak to them in their own language. And the principles he held and his commitment to common decency at a time when it seems to be going out of fashion were, inspiring, actually. And I shall really miss his contributions to the programme. Anthony in Bletchley Park, who I know you will remember with very similar feelings to mine. 11:53 is the time. Let's go to Bill in Camden as we return to the question of apparent verbal abuse and the impact it has upon the child, registered, and this is the crucial point, by the adult. Bill, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. I'm in my 60s now, and I was my father was 19 when he had me back in the early 60s, and I suspect he resented me. So all my child life and early adult life, I was abused physically and mentally. And one of the big takeaways for me was children learn to be husbands and wives, mothers and fathers when they're children. And one of the legacies one carries into adult life is precisely that you either have to reprogram or you're going to make the same mistakes. And my first marriage broke up because I think I was a dreadful husband. And I was very anxious about having children. And luckily, I was a far better father than I was a husband. But the same as for my sister, who was divorced twice. And I just think that this is one of the things we don't perhaps speak about. And only when I was in my sort of 50s or late 40s did I have an epiphany and realise, to my horror, I'd become the very thing that I dreaded becoming.
In the context of your relationship with your partners or your children, or just generally?
Well, my first wife, certainly. She deserved far better. She was very understanding about it, and right. When we divorced, we co-parented, which I thought was a big thing for her to do.
Yes,
but no amount of I've had CBT, EMDR, and all it's done is made me aware of what the issue is.
Right.
I think children are born with a very primitive operating code, like computers, and they get programmed, and to unprogram is in a huge task. And I'm completely neutral to my father, utterly neutral. I don't care what he thinks. I don't particularly care how he is. I have a very starchy relationship with my mother, who I feel should have done more and stood between her children and what was emotional danger to them.
And what about inside, as opposed to how you've interacted with the outside world? How do you feel what's happening inside you is attributable to what happened when you were little? What your dad did when you were little.
Yeah, that's the very thing, isn't it? You program your children, and if you beat a dog, don't be surprised when you get an angry dog. And I was angry for a lot of my adult life. Now I'm far more self-aware and emotionally intelligent, and I've done a lot of reading about it, and I know who I am. And I think I don't think you get over it, because the programming is just not there. You can work your way around it and try and do the best one can. But I think every now and then I can catch myself using the tone. And that's the thing, the tone you use when you speak to your children or your partners. And my father used to make himself feel better by making others feel worse. The way he spoke to my mother, for example, utterly unforgivable. And of course, to everyone else, he was polite and blustering. Only within the house was he the real person came out. And so everyone would think, what a nice chap he was. And
which gaslights the child in a way.
Exactly. And so I think I had a long chat with my children about this a year or so ago, because there was one time when I ran to drink when I was in my 30s okay. and early 40s. And there was one particular time when I spoke to them in a way that I had found unacceptable and hurtful, and I apologized to them. And my son said, "You stop drinking, and there's no better apology than that." And I just thought, for a young chap in his 20s, that was a really wise way of putting it.
That's beautiful. And your father's generation, I don't want to generalize completely, but the idea of apologizing to a child for the way that you behaved would have been anathema to older generations, wouldn't it? And yet, no. When you did it, the power that it unleashed in your family was immense.
Yeah, I mean, every now and then, if I have a snap or I'm a sharp with any of my children, I'll say later on, I'm really sorry I was a bit snappy with you. And they say, "That's quite all right, Daddy." And that release, just giving them the agency that it wasn't their fault, it was my fault, I think is really important, because there was never... he only apologised once about 15 years ago when he thought he was going to die.
Oh, Lord.
And he wanted absolution. And I said, "Yeah, fine, we're cool." And the minute he realised he wasn't going to die, guess what happened? He reverted back to where he was.
He wanted you to make him feel better in that moment and didn't care about your feelings at all.
Yeah, so thanks for listening and giving me the opportunity to share that.
Thank you for putting it so beautifully and powerfully. And as with everyone that's contributed to this hour, I'm so sorry that you've been through what you've been through, but I can promise you one thing. You have helped people who would not in a million years have phoned into the station. An awful lot of tributes coming in for Anthony in Bletchley Park as well, which is a mark, I think, that you held him in as high esteem and valued his contributions at least as much as I did. I can actually tell you a little bit more. I wanted to be completely clear. As you probably suspected when he was sharing his views on wars and terror activities, he served for decades as a senior military intelligence officer in the British Army, not just in war zones and other countries, but all over the place. Northern Ireland, Germany, Cyprus, Oman, Kosovo, the former Republic of Yugoslavia, and Iraq. And we will always be immensely grateful for his input.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, Vladimir Putin has held talks with Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, in Moscow. The meeting comes before the White House's deadline of Friday for Russia to reach a peace deal with Ukraine. The US has threatened severe economic penalties. Defence analyst Elliot Wilson says there is little expectation of a serious breakthrough.
Vladimir Putin has said again and again that he will only reach any kind of agreement once the war aims of Russia are achieved, which is Ukraine essentially becoming a vassal state. But also, I think, the vast inconsistency of Donald Trump.
Resident doctors in England have agreed what they've called a window for negotiations with the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. Members of the BMA took part in a 5-day strike last month in their row over pay. The union held talks with Mr. Streeting yesterday, described as an informative conversation. Campaigners and charities have welcomed more investment in youth services, but say it's just a start. The £88 million for England will be spent on areas like youth clubs, music lessons and climbing walls. Downing Street says there is a worrying trend of children becoming isolated at home. The Treasury's refused to be drawn on Rachel Reeves' plans to balance the public finances in the budget this autumn. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research says the Chancellor is facing a £41 billion gap in meeting her fiscal rules. The researchers have warned moderate but sustained tax rises will be needed this year. Conservative MP Jo Robertson says the Chancellor has herself to blame.
With the biggest tax burden on businesses, you can't grow an economy if you whack businesses with eye-watering taxes. Businesses drive growth and employ hard-working people.
Claire's Accessories parent company has filed for bankruptcy protection in the US. The firm, which operates in 17 countries, has around 280 shops in Britain. It was reported last month that Claire's is looking at a potential sale or restructuring of its UK business. And the Tottenham captain, Song Heung-min, is expected to complete his transfer to LAFC. He is leaving the North London side after 10 years. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 91.64. That's up 21. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather this afternoon, many areas seeing some sunny spells, but increasingly cloudy in the west. a high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, drop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after 12 and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I've got categories, haven't we, of conversations that we have. It's very rare that we'll have a conversation that is entirely new, like nothing that we've ever talked about before. Some things come around with unerring regularity. The youth club story is back in the news today. I'm tempted to talk about that because I find it such a wonderful subject, and I enjoy the therapeutic benefits of owning my wrongness about things in the past. I used to be quite dismissive of people who'd ring in when we were discussing knife crime or youth unhappiness and talk about youth clubs, and I realise now that the reason why, so I get a little bit impatient with repetition. I've told you this before. I need to get over it because it's stupid. It means I've asked the question wrong, actually, if we're not getting interesting new contributions, but it being glib or gliding over the importance of youth clubs or shared third spaces for young people was a huge error during my earlier attempts to understand knife crime at the extremities of the issue, but just general youth behaviour completely. But that we're not going to talk about that today because we've done it relatively recently. One of the reasons I love the remote working stories that pop up now with unerring regularity is that they didn't pop up at all before the lockdown. I don't think we ever had a conversation about working from home before the lockdown, which in retrospect was wrong because it was a very, it was a growing phenomenon. I suspect there were way more people working from home in 2010 than there were in 1970, for example. And by working from home, I don't mean working for yourself from home. I mean working for somebody else from home. That's why it's called remote working, because your connection with HQ or your connection with the mothership is remote. And it's gone full circle in a way. Were we a little bit knee-jerk at the time? Do you think? In our full support for it. And sometimes I worry that my position on a subject is a little bit too influenced by the opposite point of view. I remember people who've never given a monkey's about the ordinary working people of this country suddenly developing enormous concern for train drivers because they wouldn't be able to work from home. And they were usually punters, commentators, columnists who are largely in the business of protecting wealth. And we worked out pretty quickly that one of the main reasons why the big media institutions were somewhat unhinged in their opposition to growing numbers of people working from home during lockdown was because it interfered with the chat. Made me laugh. This is Kemi's best performance at PMQs by a country mile. There is no PMQ. I know that's the joke, but sometimes if you catch me unexpectedly and I start giggling, it's because someone's dropped a joke like that into my inbox. I look at the working from home thing as a footballification issue, and we perhaps shouldn't have been so quick to point out that the reason why the newspapers and other institutions and individuals were so passionately opposed to it was because they were essentially doing the bidding of commercial landlords. And commercial landlord, if you're in the business of being a sort of media concierge for epic wealth, then commercial landlords are going to very, very, very much be on your list of people who must be looked after. So we went in very hard in the opposite direction. And then a couple of things started occurring to me. You started pointing out a few things to me. Not least that I was contemplating the prospect of remote working from the perspective of my leafy suburban home. where I had a room in which I could work. I had a garden office, in fact, in which we set up a studio in the worst moments of lockdown, and I would broadcast to you from that studio. It was suboptimal. I couldn't wait to get back to work. But if I had a normal job, if I didn't have such a weird livelihood, I would have relished the chance. The thing I loved most was the amount of time I got to spend with the children, who, of course, weren't at school for much of the time. Really formative and seminal years. And I loved the lack of commute. It gave me 2 hours extra a day to do with whatever I wanted. There was so much on the list of reasons why we like it that we began to lose sight of reasons why we might not. Key among which would be younger people not living in particularly salubrious circumstances, i.e. just in shared homes with no specific workspace, and being expected to remote work when they'd rather have gone into the office. And then I started thinking about something else. And that was the simple-ish question of social life, socialising. I met my wife at work. For a long period of my life, much of my social circle was drawn from our shared working experiences. And where else do you make friends? You make friends at school, at university, at youth clubs and sporting events and what have you, or at work. And I began to think what would happen. I mean, certainly before the girls were born, we'd quite often during summer, we'd come off air and go straight to the pub. There'd be about 20 of us sitting in the pub in West London. These were fine times. But you couldn't do that if you were working from home. And so now, every time the story comes around, and it always does, today's story involves 1 in 10 businesses saying staff have quit after being told to stop working from home. Every time the story comes around, I find myself conscious of the fact that it's probably one of the first recorded examples of a footballification story turning into a pendulum story. Dun, dun, dun. Do I need to explain what those terms mean? Probably. A pendulum story is one where you can feel your mind changing in the course of our conversations. And a footballification story is one where you pick your side according to the colour of your scarf and then tie it so tightly around your neck that it cuts off the flow of blood to your brain and robs you of the ability to think clearly. And we are all guilty of footballification sometimes, even those of us who invented the word. So I thought it was footballification. I thought it was, if you are a sort of lazy, right-wing concierge for wealth who bases all of your opinions on whatever the Daily Mail has told you to think, then you will be opposed to working from home. If you are an open-minded, generous and empathetic critical thinker, then you will recognise that working from home is something that should be encouraged. What if the truth lay somewhere between those two positions rather than being ordered to pick a side and then defend it furiously? That, I don't think that is a topic, is it? I don't think we can do a phone-in yet. It's too niche, and there are so many people listening who are not fully familiar with the programme. We can't do a phone-in on. Is it footballification? Is this a topic that is turning into pendulum after being footballification? Clearly not. But a bunch of businesses surveyed during April and May, almost half of them expected staff back in the office full-time over the next year. 41% of employers thought that remote working made employers less productive. And this is where the pendulum swings. Because in the early days of remote working, they recorded the opposite finding. And I think that makes sense, because I suspect, and you're going to tell me whether this is true or not, I suspect that commute thing made us put in a little bit more work than we might previously have done. So I'm going to be more productive in the early days of working from home because I've got 2 extra hours a day or an hour and a bit extra a day or 40 minutes extra a day that I once spent commuting to and from the office. And in my head, that's not home time, that's work time. So I'm going to actually make some calls at a time when I would have been on the bus home, or I'm going to sit down at my desk half an hour earlier than I would have done if I'd had to get there via the commute. But then reality intervenes and it starts chipping away. at your new behaviours. 41% of employers now think that remote working made employers less productive. And it means that they are ordering staff back to the office, ordering staff back to work. And that means that staff are quitting and saying, I would rather not come back at all than come back under duress. It's only 10%, 9 or 10%. 9% of firms quizzed had employees who had quit over working from the office. So, 30 minutes after 12 is the time. I've got two questions here. One underpinned this issue for me from the very start. And I'll tell you that one in a minute, because the first one is the easiest. Why? So why are you ordering staff back to the office? 0345 606 0973. Actually, I've got a bunch of questions. Question number one, why are you, as a boss, insisting that staff come back to the office? Or, I guess, indeed, you never let them work from home in the first place as soon as it ceased to be a legal requirement, all right? 0345, a boss who hates working from home, especially if you've changed your mind. 0345 606 0973. Number two, the remote worker who would consider resigning if you were ordered back to the office. Tell me why, and whether or not 2020 you would recognise 2025 you. 0345 606 0973. Why would you quit? Why would you order your staff back to work? And the third question, and this is the one I find most interesting because I haven't got much skin in this game, is should the boss have the right to do it? And everyone can get involved in this. If I can prove to you that I'm producing the goods from home, so we because you remember that if 40-something percent of staff, 41% of employers think remote working made employers less productive, then 59% of employers don't think that it makes you less productive. If I can prove, I think this is philosophical. It's almost feudal. I've got a job. Due to unforeseen circumstances, it has been established that if I do that job from home, my productivity is not diminished. It either stays the same or increases, right? Should you, as my paymaster, this is why it got a bit footballification, because the kind of people who will always side with wealth, always side with capital, always side with bosses, always side with paymasters, jumped on the, oh, don't, how dare you work from home? You could spend your entire career denigrating tube drivers and then suddenly discover this extraordinary compassion for tube drivers because they were among the categories of workers who would never be able to work from home. It was quite spectacular to witness the levels of contortion and mental acrobatics that were undertaken by people who will always attack the workers in this country if they exercise, for example, collective bargaining or the right to strike. But suddenly were great defenders of them when they weren't able to join this tidal wave of remote working. But if I can prove to you that I am not being any less productive at home than I was at the office, employment law is really important. Should you be able to order me back to the office? 0345 606 0973. And that, of course, it might open the door to what happened when someone did order you back to the office. That is the bit that we can all join in on. So if you're not a boss or a remote worker, and you were thinking somewhat, I think unfairly, oh, James is leaving me out of this conversation. Of course I'm not, because I'm not a boss or a home worker. And I don't know. I've got this weird, I mentioned it to you earlier this week, it's not quite authoritarianism, but I do have a weird, a very minor tendency. I've almost entirely excised it from my personality. But I have still got a slight tendency to forelock tug. I've got a slight tendency to, you know, top of the morning, squire, to sort of, I hate it. I hate the fact that I'm admitting this to you. I can slot into the natural order of things in a way that is a little bit embarrassing for me. And that's perhaps why I feel that even if I wasn't in any way being less productive at work, if the boss says, well, I want you in the office, then I say, yes, boss. Is that right? Come into this from whatever angle you want. 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. So come at it whichever way you want. Why you don't like remote working as an employer, why you love it so much as a remote worker that if you were ordered to stop it, you'd quit. Or the area I find most interesting, should it be in the, what's the word I want, the remit of the employer to insist on where you work? They're in charge of what you do, and they could have quite a lot of control over how you do it, but should they be able to determine, simply by dint of paying your wages, should they be able to order you to work in a certain place? In this case, the office. 0345 6060973. I'm going to throw in one more as well. You've gone off it a bit. You thought it was brilliant when it started, but now you really miss elements of regular off. So you've changed your mind about it. You're always welcome on this programme if you've changed your mind about whatever subject it is that we're discussing. 12:18 is the time.
This is LBC.
Guess what? M&S have 20% off school uniform until the 6th of August.
Why?
Because you need new uniforms, school shoes, and don't forget undies.
Why?
Because you're growing up way too fast. Best-in-class uniform from M&S that's durable, reliable, and hand-me-downable. Shop in-store today. Terms and conditions apply.
Why?
You could be a lotto millionaire like Terry. Get your ticket for tonight's draw. The National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 5% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that dream holiday or a weekend getaway. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.89% gross. Terms apply.
Introducing McDonald's side missions. Every weekday, an exclusive mission will drop in the app. Today only came a 119 mayo chicken with a perfect companion side mission. With a chance to win prizes every weekend, tap the banner and start a side mission now. 18 plus app only. Ends 10th of August. One play per day. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. Serving times and T&Cs apply.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
I didn't even know the phrase third spaces before. You know, just seeing a couple of news reports about the effort the government's putting into providing youth clubs and similar for young people. It's nothing to do with screens, really, is it? It's all to do with the eradication of third spaces that were previously in place. And it's an illustration of how differently we think about the world. And sometimes we don't think about the world differently until we're sort of forced to by circumstances. And remote working, home working was never a thing until suddenly it was. Suddenly it was everywhere and it became quite a heated debate very, very quickly. And I wonder whether we got it a little bit wrong by siding ourselves, aligning ourselves completely with the remote working brigade. But that's where the third element of this phoning comes in, the idea that there's something a little bit pathetic about believing that the boss should have the right to order you back to the office. What do you think? 0345 6060973. Jeanette's in Lyme Regis. Jeanette, what would you like to say?
Hi. Well, hello. I'm part of the remote working brigade, and by dint of the fact that I'm quite a distance from our head office anyway, I wouldn't be able to go back into the office. But the interesting point for me is that our team is 10 people. 50% of us work from home, 50% in the office. By far the most productive members of the team, in fact, the top five, are the ones working from home.
And that's measurable, is it?
Yes. All our KPIs, yeah. From time speaking on
what's
the phone to customers.
What's a KPI?
A key performance indicator, so
thank
it's a measure of success.
No, I could have worked out what it was. I just didn't know what it stood for. Key performance indicators. And they're publicly available. You can all see how each other are performing on KPI.
Yes.
Well, you're safe as houses then, aren't you?
Well, yes. I think one of the downfalls is if there are any promotions going, you can forget it. If you're not, because you're not there, your face doesn't fit, if you like. So they like what we do in terms of results, but that's it.
Or, if I can't see you on a regular basis, I can't really manage you. And therefore, if you can't see me on a regular basis, you can't be a manager. Isn't it a bit more than your face not fitting? Or not?
Well, yes. I mean, yes, I agree to an extent. But
that's what I'm looking for.
James, we have got teams.
No, I know. But that's... Oh, yeah. Is it the same, do you think?
It could be. I think it just takes the will.
Would you promote somebody who never came into the office?
I don't know.
I think you do. but that's
the
point. Well, hardly. It's the point of this conversation, isn't it? Is that there's a lot of stuff happening now that was not part of the conversation when we first started having it. Did you do it before lockdown?
I was self-employed before lockdown.
So this is a job that probably wouldn't have existed without that discovery about the relationship between working from home and productivity. And therefore, if they turned around tomorrow and said, I'm really sorry, I know you're having a lovely life down there in Lyme Regis, but if you're not back in the office on Monday morning, you can look for another job.
I'd have to look for another job.
Should your employer have that right?
Yes, I think they probably should have the right at the end of the day. A right, I'm not saying they would be right, but they think they have the right.
That's because they're paying the bills, they get to decide where we go.
Yeah.
What a great call. I love this because you've got so much nuance and simultaneously right and wrong and recognising that you may not do the thing that you're quite resentful about the other person doing to you when it comes to promotions. But you're happy with your lot. That is the point.
Yes.
And long may it continue. Jeanette, thank you. Who's going to tell me why Jeanette's employer should not be able to? Remember, she's in the top five in her team. So for the employer to turn around and say, right, I need you back in the office on Monday, when the people who are in the office are measurably performing worse than her. Who's going to make the argument powerfully for why no employer should have that right at all? 0345 6060 973. But also, it just touched on something there that I thought was really interesting on the promotion issue. None of the people working remotely are getting the promotions. What I'd really like to know is what has changed in your experience of this issue or your relationship of this issue. The longer it's gone on, this is why I think it's a pendulum issue, the longer it's gone on, the more you have discovered. I'll tell you why I've changed my mind, James, or I'll tell you what's different about this. I never thought that ... I never thought I wouldn't get promoted. I never thought I'd really miss socialising. I never thought that not being in the office, and you can do this from either side, employer or employee. And the question, so Davey's not very impressive because it's the most stupid question I've ever heard. Should tune in more, mate. Of course your boss has the right to tell you where to work. I think you're missing the point, pal. Why? 0345 6060 973. If they've got the right to tell you where to work, what other rights do they have over your personal autonomy? Do they have the right to tell you when you can and can't use the toilet, what you can and can't wear, where you can and can't go for lunch, what you can eat while you're on company premises? Hey, you may well answer yes to all of these questions, but would you really want to work for that boss as opposed to one that recognised your independence and your autonomy? What toothpaste do you use? 25 minutes after 12 is the time. Ben's in Nottingham. Ben, what do you reckon?
Hiya, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
I think I have probably a good perspective on this because I've sat on both sides of the camp. So I used to work fully remotely for about 4 years, never in the office. And then now I'm the manager of a team of about 200. So I can kind of see it from both sides. But I think...
How many of those 200 work remotely?
Very few work fully remotely, but everyone does hybrid working.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think my issue with it is you have people on both ends of the spectrum, and the employees that are ardently full-time working from home, they kind of frame the argument in the wrong way. I think they try and claim productivity is higher. They try and claim that being in an office is more distracting and those kind of things, when the reality is it's not that. I don't think. I think there's obviously benefits to being in an office.
What are they?
Collaborative learning, I think, is really important. So if you imagine a trainee coming in, I don't believe you can fully grasp the culture of a business, the understanding of its systems by being at home personally.
So you're
going to
have... Well, there could be people in their 20s who don't know what they're missing in a way and who are actually going to develop more slowly than colleagues who've got more collaborative environments.
I believe so, yeah. I mean, there's this idea that socialising seems to stop at school as well. I don't know when we stopped socialising in a workplace, but I know I've made friends through work.
Same.
And I'm sure plenty of others have.
Yes.
And being around people is just it's just nice. And I found that really tough when I was working from home. I used to have to go out at lunchtime for a coffee or something because otherwise I wouldn't see anyone that day.
Yeah.
And that's quite an isolating position to be in. So I think really the best position lies somewhere in the middle, as with most things. But the argument probably needs reframing from the employees. Don't try and sell this as a huge productivity gain or something that's really great for employers. The fact of the matter is it's the biggest win, I think, in the employee-employer relationship in years. The loss of commute costs, the loss of commute time is fantastic. But just sell it as that. That's why we want to do it, is because it's good for us.
But it's not a I'm going to use one of those dreadful management words. It's not a disbenefit for the employer, though, any of that.
I don't believe so. No, I think that there can be times when you do, if you've got teams where certain people are working from home on different days, you have got a situation where maybe you've gone from those two people being sat next to each other 5 days a week to those two people being sat next to each other 3 days a week. That is going to have an impact on their collaborative work.
All roads lead to hybrid when we have these conversations. And I'm more interested, oddly, I'm more interested in the extremities, but I suspect the extremities are becoming increasingly rare as the hybrid recognises the power of compromise that you describe. But I sense that, well, I don't sense it. You said it. The argument that I'm much better is becoming a little bit hollow, where what you want is for people to say, look, my life is much better. And
exactly
my productivity
that
is not being particularly affected. So please stop pretending that this is something all employers should be doing with all employees on measurable performance grounds.
100%. Yeah, yeah, 100%. And one thing, you did have another question there, which was about should employers
I was just coming to that. Go on.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Should employers be allowed to force people back to work? And I think I understand your position on that, but I think that what I would say is it does depend what the job description is. If your job description is you need to produce this many items in this amount of time,
or field this many calls, or fill in that many forms,
exactly,
or
that,
whatever it
then
is,
then that makes complete sense. But I would say most comprehensive job descriptions have an element of you need to help train younger people, and you need to do other elements of the job which are potentially not so easily done from home, and that's where you'll see you're not delivering on those areas of the job as well, potentially.
Yeah, so it's not black and white, but you lean heavily towards the employer having the right to say,
yeah,
we will lose staff if we don't.
So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what the story is about. Nice one, Ben. Thank you for that. Jamie goes a little further. You think that because they are paying the bills, they get to say jump, and your only response should be how high? That's ludicrous. It's not feudal times anymore, and the boss is not a liege lord. A special prize to Jamie for deploying the phrase liege lord in the phoning about working from home. I can't believe how regressive this nonsense is. Well, to be fair, pal, you sent that before Ben pointed out that the job description itself. Well, no, because if the job description itself contains things that you can only do in the office, then you wouldn't be working from home now, would you? So I think the question remains. The pendulum swings again. 12:30 is the time. Dominic Ellis is here with your headlines.
President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is holding talks with Vladimir Putin in Moscow. It comes before Mr. Trump's Friday deadline for Russia to reach a peace deal with Ukraine or face new sanctions. Resident doctors in England have agreed a window for negotiations with the health secretary. Members of the BMA took part in a 5-day strike last month in their row over pay. And the Chancellor has been warned that tax rises will be needed this autumn to plug a $41 billion gap in the public finances. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research says Rachel Reeves is facing an impossible situation. LBC weather, most areas fine and dry with sunny spells. Cloud will increase across some areas in the west, highs of 24 degrees.
LBC.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips?
Your best bet is to head to BitVictor.
Why's that?
They've got more features than you can shake a stick at. They've got cash out. They've got in-play football, racing, tennis, all your favourite sports. They've got the best odds guaranteed on racing. And then there's the bet builder. And, of course, you've got the lucky dip. Blimey, dip! I've got to go, fella. It's Nacho Night at Casa Rednap. And holy moly, I forgot the guacamole. Ay, caramba.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet at BitVictor. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. Gambleaware.org.
So, where are we going?
You wanted to try something new? Well, we're here.
The Hyundai electrifying summer event.
I booked a test drive in the all-new Insta online. It's the 2025 World Electric Vehicle winner, and we save £500 if we order before the 31st of August.
Ooh, very stylish.
Oh, and it's Hyundai.
by the way.
The Hyundai Electrifying Summer Event. Are you in? 18 plus UK retail customers only. Excludes Motability. Registered by 30th of September. T's and C's apply.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Squid Game, Dad.
Let's watch it together this weekend. That'd be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
Four. That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV. Plus, change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary, terms apply.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It's 12:33. I've got an unhinged headline for you this hour. We haven't done one for a while. This is an absolute doozy. Trust me. But I mean, what do you do with headlines that look unhinged but are actually simply reporting the news? It's increasingly the case, isn't it? That category seems to be growing all the time. And I've shared with you in the past my worries about not being able to keep up with it all, particularly on the other side of the Atlantic. There's so much mad stuff happening there. There's the mad stuff that's mad, like Donald Trump getting on the roof the other day and no one was quite sure why. Did you see that? He was just on the roof. It reminded me of Homer Simpson, except Homer Simpson's really likable. He was just standing on the roof. No one knew what he was doing up there, really. Might have been something to do with his new ballroom. And now I wonder whether I've been the victim of AI manipulation and he was never on the roof at all, which is another example of how hard it is to keep up with all the mad stuff. But then some of the mad stuff is happening. And in this case, it is the Department of Health and Human Services that are doing it. So Robert Kennedy Jr., who's a challenging character, and a well-known so-called vaccine skeptic, or science denier, if you prefer, is cancelling £500 million worth of funding for precisely the sort of vaccines that counter viruses like COVID, bird flu and similar. And you read these headlines, even though you know that he has a long track record of being bonkers, you read these headlines and you sort of find yourself thinking, how can this be happening? And then you find yourself thinking, is this as bad as it looks? Because we've got a sort of normality bias, haven't we? We're presented with something that looks absolutely abnormal, absolutely crazy. And you think, well, hang on a minute, the grown-ups are doing it. And even if he appears to be very strange, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is technically a grown-up. He's the Secretary of State for Health. So maybe taking away £500 million worth of funding for the viruses that combat things like COVID is not quite as crackers as it sounds to an amateur like me at first glance. Perhaps it would be something that is both understood and approved of by people who aren't fellow science deniers. I do not know. So what did Anne Applebaum tell us yesterday? Well, she reminded us yesterday of what we do when we find ourselves in danger of drowning in a sea of propaganda and misinformation, misunderstanding and ignorance. You've got to speak to an expert. Professor Robin Shattuck is a professor of infection at Imperial College London, and he led the UK self-amplifying COVID mRNA vaccines during the pandemic. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much did I sound like I knew what I was talking about when I said the phrase self-amplifying COVID mRNA vaccines? We may never know. But Robin has worked on such vaccines against threats such as Ebola, Lassa fever, bird flu, Marburg, and as I mentioned a moment ago, COVID itself. We'll begin, if we may, Robin, with the headline. RFK Jr. cancels $500 million in funding for mRNA vaccines. How alarmed are you by that?
Well, it's concerning not just because of the actual cuts, but really the message that it sends. Now, obviously, you know, the US is totally entitled to decide where they want to put their research budget. Interestingly, some of the people they cite that they've cut research funding to either were unaware that they were getting funding, like Moderna. They say they have no funding from BARDA, though the cuts are done. One company that cited no longer trade. So there's some strange information there. But the major point here is that he's using pseudoscience to justify these decisions, saying that these vaccines are unsafe, and that they don't work. And this completely flies against all the evidence that we have for vaccines, and particularly for mRNA vaccines, that were instrumental at preventing deaths and keeping people out of hospital during the pandemic.
How much energy can you afford to put into tracking how people like him end up where they've ended up and what influences they are operating under?
Well, I think it's very difficult. I mean, this decision is pretty predictable by the field. But of course, he has his own agenda. He has sacked the vaccine experts that look at all these data and has appointed a panel of experts that represent the same viewpoint that he has, which is really contrary to all the scientific data that we have. So it's quite easy to provide some kind of legitimization of his viewpoint if he's appointing people who just agree with his viewpoint rather than represent independent scientists.
I hope I'm not being pedantic, but and it may have been a slip of the tongue, but you describe the people he's appointed as experts. Is that
So, well, it depends how you define experts.
That's what I'm asking.
So these are people that have some scientific background, but are not experts in vaccine development, vaccine safety. So they have some legitimacy in having a scientific background, but these would not be experts that would be recognised by regulatory authorities.
I see. And those were the kind of people who rose to prominence originally on social media during lockdown, during the worst moments of COVID, and who presumably were the source of Robert F. Kennedy's misunderstandings in the broader field. So he's essentially, having been gaslit online, he's brought the gaslighters into government.
Yeah, this is absolutely the case.
Wow.
And this is really concerning, not just for RNA technology, but for vaccines in general. As you're aware, you know, there's been a major measles outbreak in the US. He's not endorsed vaccines as being the best measure to prevent those outbreaks. It increases people's hesitancy around vaccines, which, you know, beyond clean water, are the biggest public health benefit that's been discovered in this century.
I love that comparison, and it's obviously watertight, if you pardon the pun. But how, on a personal level, Robin, how surprised are you that we are having conversations like this? Not specifically about Robert F. Kennedy and this latest budget cut, but also a conversation predicated on the fact that there are two sides to the argument about the efficacy and importance of vaccines. I presume when you started your career, you thought that those arguments were over.
Well, I think, again, the danger is saying there are two sides.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you say there are two sides, it gives the impression that they have equal merit. But in fact, the majority, the absolute vast majority of scientists and clinicians would support vaccination as an appropriate and safe strategy against a few motivated individuals that want to discredit the technology for their own agenda.
And you'd expect, because we think somewhat naively that these things will follow the laws of logic, that things like measles outbreaks would provide the mother of all head wobbles for the people that you described. But they don't, do they? Because it's not science versus science, as you've just reminded us. It's science versus cultishness, almost.
Absolutely. And also the other thing that's very challenging, I think, is that vaccines are so successful that we rarely see the diseases that they prevent. So we see the side effects, and we're measuring a side effect against not getting a vaccine rather than the disease. But if you ask people who are sitting in a situation where they're seeing infectious diseases every day, if they want vaccines and they're not able to get them, they would be clamoring to have those vaccines.
How concerned should we be? Viruses don't respect borders. The USA obviously leads where much of the rest of the world follows, but I don't I suppose there's two questions. I don't see much danger of the political becoming contagious here, but how damaging could a widespread government-endorsed opposition to these kinds of vaccines be for the broader planet, for the bigger population?
Well, I think that, that certainly in the UK, there won't be that political contamination. You know, I think we have much more faith in the expertise of our own institutions for regulating vaccines in this country. And in terms of the technology, it actually gives an opportunity for places like the UK to lead with these types of technology with the right investments. It is slightly more concerning on a global scale because institutions that are preparing for future pandemics are quite dependent on US funding. So, for example, you know, the lack of US funding for organizations like the WHO and other vaccine developers that are preparing for future pandemics will be impacted by what goes in, on in the US.
A final question. Have we, I use the word very loosely, have we done enough to combat the sort of misinformation that Robert F. Kennedy is a victim of and, of course, a champion of as well?
Well, I think it's a continual battle to make sure that evidence-based science is communicated, and scientists and doctors, you know, really need to step up to the plate and make sure they communicate both the benefits and the risks of any medicine so that people can make informed decisions rather than just, you know, listening to the latest trend on social media.
Yeah, I mean, it's true of so many of the conversations that we have on this programme at the moment, but the stakes, as you've reminded us, are rarely as high as they would be in a case like this. Professor Robin Chattuck, thank you so much. A professor of infection at Imperial College London, but obviously, you know, Billy Bunch of numbers on your Auntie Doris's Facebook page probably knows more about the facts than Robin does. That seems to be how public discourse works in this country. Here's an example. Nobody believes you, mate. Didn't the Oxford vaccine get pulled because of how dangerous it was? So, again, in the spirit of what Professor Chattuck said about dealing with misinformation, the vaccine you're referring to was a billion times better than nothing. But as the science progressed, other vaccines were developed that were even better than that one, so they stopped using that one. And the measure of how good or how bad something is a bit like reading the small print in your paracetamol box and discovering that sometimes that can have terrible side effects. So even if the bad effect is infinitesimal and tiny, if something comes along where the possibility of a side effect, a bad side effect, is even tinier, clever clogs, then you go with the one with the even tinier likelihood of something bad happening. But, you know, we're here now four years later and you're still texting this programme with that nonsense. And I don't mean to be... Well, I do mean to be rude, actually, because you're clearly an idiot. But the fact that you can still think that it's... Oh, I'm going to tell him he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's talking to a professor from Imperial College London. I'm Billy Bunch of Numbers. I'm big on Facebook, and you still think that that's an argument that hasn't been fully and completely addressed. That's the problem that we were just alluding to while also reflecting upon the fact that £500 million worth of cuts, dollars worth of cuts for funding precisely the vaccines that counter things like bird flu could only happen if idiots like you had somehow persuaded yourself that you had a better grasp of the science than the most informed and educated people on the planet. It's 12:46.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Music lessons, sports, drama, climbing, debating and volunteering. The government provides £88 million for children to get them off screen and mixing. Will it work?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Get the news your way and combine breaking news with expert opinion to see the full picture.
With award-winning journalism on air and in your hand, the LBC app puts you in control.
The biggest stories of the day delivered how you want it
and when you want it.
Download the LBC app
Now.
News. Your way.
Now. In your hands.
Body pain might not sound like this.
Oh.
Or this.
Oh.
But it might sound like this.
I'm fine.
Hiding your body pain behind a smile? Let us help. With up to 12 hours of uninterrupted muscle and joint pain relief. Voltarol, the joy of movement. Voltarol Joint and Back Pain Relief 2.3% gel contains diclofenac diethylammonium. Always read the label.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with a McDonald's side mission. Do you A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 5% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that dream holiday or a weekend getaway. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.89% gross. Terms apply.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge. Helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex, as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
12:49 is the time. Over-tourism can have a large impact affecting local environments and economies. That's why LBC is investigating tourism and how travel can be done better thanks to Intrepid Travel. This afternoon, Sheila Fogarty will be joined by the UK General Manager at Intrepid Travel, Joanna Reeve, to discuss how mass tourism is affecting countries. That's coming up after one, thanks to Intrepid Travel. You're listening to me, James O'Brien, and it's 12:49. Back to the conversation in hand, which is about the rights and wrongs of working from home. Keith, could we prepare the unhinged headline audio, please? And I have remembered my anecdote. Would you like to hear my brown sauce anecdote? Why do you roll your eyes like that? It's among the most middle-class things anybody could ever say. You can take this one to the bank, all right? So I can't quite remember why, but I ended up with a lot of dates. All right, I had a glut of dates. I think we must all have bought dates at the same time. Well, we all went out to buy, and we knew we needed some dates for a recipe, but we all bought dates. So we ended up with way more dates than we've ever needed. I was looking up things that you can do with dates, and I discovered a recipe by Raymond Blanc, the super chef, for... Can you guess what it was for? Yes, you're right. I made my own brown sauce, thanks to Raymond Blanc's recipe. And here's the thing. We're not yet at the most middle class. Actually, that's pretty high, isn't it? I made my own brown sauce. It gets worse. No one else in the house is remotely interested. They've never eaten brown sauce at all. I've always been an HP man. And I started eating it, obviously. I had quite a lot of it. And kept it in the fridge in bottles. And I initially thought, this isn't as delicious as I thought it was going to be. Raymond Blanc described it as the basis, the foundation stone of the finest bacon sandwich of all time. And the first time I ate it, I thought he'd over-egged that particular pudding, to be honest with you. But after about a month, I was thinking, actually, this is really nice. And then you'll never guess what happened. This is the most middle-class thing that's ever happened to me in the kitchen. Even more so when I got a blister stirring my risotto. I had some HP sauce. I was out for breakfast, and I had some HP sauce on my breakfast, and it was gross. It was so vinegary. I couldn't quite believe it, so I could never go back now. I'm going to have to make my own brown sauce for the rest of my life, because it turns out that once you've gone down the Raymond Blanc route, you can never go back to the HP or the daddies. And there you go. That is, I think we can all agree, the most middle-class anecdote that you've ever heard. 12:52 is the time. I will never be making my own ketchup. Do not worry. I can't imagine any paha. My inbox is going to go nuts now, isn't it? Let's get back to working from home and then do a unhinged headline and then hopefully squeeze in one more call as well. Let's go to Luke in Guildford. Luke, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Just wanted to say, like, I started working from home in 2020 in March, and since then I went on to have three children very young. So I've got twins and I've got a five-year-old as well. So for me to work from home is ideal situation, and obviously financially cost-effective for me massively, because what we've done is we got rid of our second car to help with the ever-rising costs.
Right, I mean, you kind of tally with what the boss who rang in was saying, is that people need to be honest about the reasons why they prefer it and stop pretending that they're actually better workers. As long as you're roughly the same in terms of productivity, you should just stick with it. What if the boss said to you now, hey, Luke, really sorry, I need you back in the office on Monday for good?
Well, the thing with that is, I was telling your producer, is that it would never happen, because cost effectiveness might leave my partner at home without a car facility to get anywhere. We live in like a remote location, so she'd be stuck between the four walls with three young kids, and it wouldn't actually work.
So you'd have to leave the job?
I'd have to. There's no, my hands would be forced to leave the job, which would then be ideal, which put me on more financial stress and more financial...
Find another job that let you work from home. Yeah. So I suspect that that's going to inform your answer to this question, but it didn't with the first person I asked. What do you think about... I mean, productivity not affected by you working from home. Your life improved and enhanced in immeasurable ways. Under employment law, should your employer have the right to order you back to the office?
I don't think so in this day and age. I don't think so. If the opportunity is there and it works to give that employee that work-life balance, then I don't see why you wouldn't want to offer it and to keep that employee happy, and it's going to produce good numbers for what you're doing.
Because they're chasing something other than commercial success or productivity. They're just kind of trying to prove that they're the boss of you.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So, and I think what as well is when one other point is, I'm slightly older than a lot of people in my department within where I work. Right. So what I find is I go to the office and I'm not like an 18, 19 year old. I'm not indiscriminative, but I'm not like a kid that's, look, I've got a family that I'm trying to look after and trying to obviously make sure they have a good life, a start in life, as opposed to an 18, 19 year old who's there is looking to, just to make some money to go out and beer money, you know? So I think that the difference between the two is obviously I can just crack on and get my work done.
But they're treating you like individuals, actually, recognizing that you're at different stages in life and that a good employer would want that to be reflected in the way that you get treated. And it makes you probably more loyal, even though you're not there. Beautifully put, Luke. Thank you, mate. 12:55 is the time. We haven't done one of these for a while.
Unhinged headline.
You can tell we haven't done it for a while because my own production makes me laugh. Well, not my own production, but the production on my own radio show makes me laugh. This is a good one. Snowflake lawyers are destroying a proud profession, writes Suella Braverman. Here's the first few lines. Inevitably, it's in the Daily Telegraph. If it's unhinged, it's in the Daily Telegraph 99% of the time. Ready? Britain's legal profession, once a byword for rigour, intellect and integrity, now finds itself the latest battleground in the war against excellence. Whatever passes for editorial policy at the Daily Telegraph doesn't feel minded to remind you about Suella Braverman's qualifications for commenting upon the rigour, intellect and integrity of the legal profession. Because when she was a lawyer, I know, but when she was a lawyer, her biography on her Chambers website claimed that she had contributed to a legal textbook, which makes her sound perhaps much cleverer than you ever would previously have thought. She contributed to a legal textbook called Gambling for Local Authorities, Licensing, Planning and Regeneration. There was, however, for this paragon and indeed champion of, let me get the words absolutely right, rigour, intellect and integrity in the legal profession. There was, however, one problem with her claim that she had contributed to a legal textbook called Gambling for Local Authorities, Licensing, Planning and Regeneration. The author of the actual book, Philip Colvin KC, revealed that she did not make a single contribution to the book. He added, however, on one occasion, I asked her to do some photocopying for the book, which she did. As soon as The Big Issue, who unearthed this story a few years ago, contacted the chambers where Suella Braverman's biography was displayed, it mysteriously disappeared and was removed. She was at the Home Office at the time, where they also declined to comment on this story when approached by The Big Issue. The entire contents of her profile on the Chambers website were since removed. Staff said, according to The Big Issue, that she asked them to remove the profile after The Big Issue made contact about the claim, but a copy of the web page is still available online through the Internet Archive. So if you ever need lecturing on the rigour, intellect and integrity of Britain's legal profession, then you go to a woman who claimed to have contributed to a legal textbook which the actual author remembered instead as a single request to ask her to do some photocopying. And that is why snowflake lawyers are destroying a proud profession is an absolute doozy of a...
Unhinged headlines.
Should that have been un? Should that have been of un? It should, shouldn't it? Of un. Can we do it again? An absolute doozy of an...
Unhinged headline.
Oh, I don't know now. What do you think?
I think you need to re-record the unhinged headline thing and put the word an unhinged headline in it.
Headline.
And then you just say, and that's
an unhinged headline.
Sheila, have you any idea how long it took me to get that one?
I've been in radio a long time. Yes. You'll get there. You'll get there. Months and months.
Anyway, the professional has arrived in the building, as you can tell. So
that's right.
It's time to move on. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on Global Player and the LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinions. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts. So download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you, an unhinged woman. thank you, James. The three today. I'm going to be joined by Lewis Goodall for a bit during that hour because he's just back from Hiroshima, 80 years since the atomic bomb was dropped. There we'll also hear from the granddaughter of a Japanese prisoner of war who says it was necessary. Two Marks and Spencers has apologised after a trans employee offered to help a 14-year-old girl and her mother who were shopping in the bra department. Should M&S have apologised? But I'm going to start with a move by the government to the tune of £88 million to get kids off their screens by giving them more opportunities around and about where they live, both outdoors and indoors. Music lessons, sport, drama, you know the stuff we used to do.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is holding talks with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. They're discussing efforts to end the war in Ukraine before Mr. Trump's Friday deadline for Moscow to reach a peace deal. Washington has threatened severe tariffs and other penalties if the fighting doesn't stop. Tony Brenton is a former British ambassador to Russia.
It's interesting that Witkoff is going, apparently, because the Russians have invited him, which suggests that Putin has something to offer, in the hope of seeing off whatever the prospect of sanctions might be. The sanctions threatened by the United States at the moment actually don't look very effective. They're going to depend upon Chinese and Indian cooperation, which they're almost certainly not going to get.
Israel's defense minister has insisted the IDF will follow the government's orders on its operations in Gaza. It follows reports of opposition from senior military officials of a potential expansion of the campaign. A man's been jailed for at least 25 years for the murder of a grandmother in Suffolk. Anita Rose, who was 57, was found with serious injuries in Brantham last July and died later in hospital. Prosecutors say 56-year-old Roy Barkley subjected her to a vicious and brutal attack, describing him as irrational and dangerous. The Treasury says its focus remains on growing the economy to strengthen the public finances. An economic think tank has urged the Chancellor to make moderate but sustained tax rises in her autumn budget. It's identified a $41 billion shortfall in one of Rachel Reeves' self-imposed fiscal rules. David Aikman is from the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, which carried out the report.
Given the scale of the gap we've identified in the report, 40 billion, as you said, it will need to be one of the big areas of tax revenue in the UK. That means either income tax, VAT, national insurance contributions.
Resident doctors in England have agreed a window for negotiations with the Health Secretary. Members of the BMA took part in a five-day strike last month in their row over pay. The union held talks with Wes Streeting yesterday, describing them as an informative conversation. And Everton have become the first Premier League club to sign up to a voluntary living pension scheme. The target's designed to help people save for a decent standard of living in retirement. It'll apply to everyone who works at the club. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 17 at 91.60. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather, most areas fine and dry with sunny spells this afternoon. Cloud will increase across some western areas with highs of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. In about, 50 minutes time actually during this hour, we're going to speak to Shivani Sharma, LBC's East of England reporter, about that news you will have just heard in the bulletin there, the verdict around the killing of 57-year-old Anita Rose. The man who killed her has been sentenced to at least 25 years in jail. So Shivani will give us an update on that around 10 to 2. But the first thing I want to talk to you about today, given that we've spoken so much about online safety, particularly of children, and given that we've talked as well in recent weeks, for the first time in a while, actually, we've talked a lot about knife crime again and how much that involves very young people. An announcement today by the government of an £88 million package for youth services, children's services, activities, things like music lessons, sport, drama, climbing, debating, volunteering, the kind of stuff that many kids are still fortunate enough to do, but many are not. And there's a tendency, there's a sort of societal shift away from it, isn't there? Partly because of social media. I'd be happier if there was another eight in that package, £888 million, but needs must, small start. But do you think this is the way to go? We know that because of austerity, many children's services were lost. Youth clubs and things way beyond youth clubs as well, counselling services, that kind of thing. Do you think that this is enough of a start? I have to say my sense is no, it's not enough of a start. It's good. I think it's a good thing. They're all good things. But I don't think it's enough of a start. I think we could be a lot more ambitious with how we sort of re-energise young people and children and how we get them re-engaged both with one another and with life so that they choose life instead of just the screen and, worse still, death. Or they're there for the picking by county lines, gangs and the like. I think it is a start, but I think there's more that could be done. But given what they're offering here with £88 million, music lessons, sports, drama, climbing, volunteering, day trips away, that kind of thing, is this the kind of thing you want to see the government doing? Is it something that you think your child will respond to, or the children you teach, children you deal with every day, will respond to? 0345 6060 973. Jamie Masraf joins me, Chief Executive of Onside Youth Zones, a national charity which builds and supports youth clubs. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you for having me on.
It's very easy to dismiss these kinds of things as soft skills, soft activities, added extras, non-essentials. I would argue the complete opposite. I'm guessing you would argue the complete opposite as well. What do you make of this offering from the government?
So the first thing I think to say is that we very much welcome the fact that the government is is prioritising young people, is investing in young people and recognising the critical role that activities outside of school, support outside of school, plays in young people's lives. So it is, first and foremost, it's a really, you know, this investment is a really important signal to young people that they matter, and what support and activities is there for them is important, and that needs to go beyond the screen. But I completely agree with what you said, and that, you know, another eight and then
add an eight,
exactly,
at the very least,
is needed, because, you know, the challenge, we have to set this in the context of, you know, the last 15 years for young people have been a terrible decade and a half, you know, in terms of the youth sector that supports them. Government as a whole spends a quarter of what it does per year than it did 15 years ago. That's a real terms cut of £1.2 billion a year less being spent on young people. Plus, you know, they're constantly getting the thin end of the wedge. Let's think about COVID, where the fact, you know, they were locked down, it was impossible for them to go to school, to interact, to spend time with each other, which is so crucial for their development. And now they're struggling with another problem of social media. You know, instead of giving them opportunities and activities to do outside of school and outside of their home, what we're saying to young people, the message we're sending is, no, go inside your room, go inside your bedroom and spend time on your phone. And that's both has its own risks and issues, but also means they're not spending time in real life. They're not trying new things, developing the skills that we know are so crucial for life. So it's a welcome step, but not enough.
And, you know, you talk there about the youth sector. Even things like, even within the education, even within schools, we know that music lessons have been cut. We know that drama has been cut. We know that things like debating and volunteering aren't necessarily still happening in every school because of the teacher shortages or the time that teachers don't have to do these kinds of things. And for, you know, for lucky children, these things will still be part of their lives. Mum and dad will have enough money. Grandparents might wade in with a bit of money to help them to go on those school trips or whatever it happens to be. But it's a massive strain for some families to be able to give kids those supposed extras. And just personally speaking, I remember going to senior school at the age of 11 and being really excited about the expansion there was from, I mean, I had a great time in primary school, but it's different, isn't it? You go into senior school, it's different. The expansion of what was available to me in terms of sports, in terms of music, in terms of...